Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here as always to talk about stuff this week on the show. What don't we have to talk about?
We don't have Doctor Who to talk about.
We have
everything to talk about.
We have a little bit of everything. We are going to go over a crap ton of news, a lot of it out of Comic-Con, just fun different entertainment things that are interesting. We are going to talk some movies. I saw Dunkirk. Sean caught up on the Apes movies.
Yes, I have watched all three of them now.
Yeah, the new Planet of the Apes movies.
Yes.
The confusingly titled ones.
They're all confusingly titled. The only one that's not confusingly titled is the first Planet of the Apes movies titled Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
That one made sense.
So we're going to talk those movies. We're going to talk a couple of different games. We're going to do a little bit of follow-up on the Destiny 2 beta chat. You played it last week and were able to talk about it. I played it a bunch. I don't know if we have a ton to add to that, but we'll mention it. I got Splatoon 2 and have been loving it. So we'll talk Splatoon, and you're going to talk Nier Automata.
Yeah.
Because you finally finished it.
I beat that game, and that holy fucking shit, that game is really good.
Nice. It feels like you've gotten more enthusiastic about it each week.
Yeah, well, when we get to that, you will find out how true that statement is when we get to me actually talking about it proper later in the show.
You know, I did try Nier Automata. I played about half an hour of it, and I couldn't get, or maybe an hour of it, I couldn't get into it. Maybe it's worth me taking a second look.
It is worth you taking a second look. That is a true statement. You should play that game.
Okay. Well, anywho, let's go ahead and jump right into it. Before we get into stuff, I have a little bit of housekeeping for us.
Okay.
Next week is episode 200.
Yes, it is.
You'll hear a little bit more about that at the end of the show.
Yeah.
But, yeah, as one of the projects I've wanted to get in order before episode 200, we have a new website.
What? A new website?
JonathanLack.com isn't gone. It's not going anywhere. In fact, I have some writing I'm going to be putting up there soon. And I will probably still post the podcast there as a main release thing. But we do have now WeeklyStuffPodcast.com.
Yes.
You can go there. I had to do a lot of work with the people on my domain registry to make sure it did it without the www, which it wasn't working with for a while. But now it does. So, WeeklyStuffPodcast.com or www.WeeklyStuffPodcast.com if you want to do that.
Yeah.
And archived there, every single episode of the show. The newest episode will be right there on top. And you can click on any episode, expand it. It'll give you the full show notes, the time charts, if it's applicable to that episode. You can download the episode as an MP3. You can stream it right from there. The entire archive is as easy as it has ever been to access. You also have links to our Twitter accounts on there, links to the iTunes subscription, links to the RSS feed if you want to feed that into anywhere else. So it is as easy as it has ever been. I think it looks simple but very nice. I'm very happy with it. And that page will be expanding with some other things as we announce new things in the future. But it's a really simple website. Basically, it's through our podcast hosting service, and that kind of they keep it up for us. And I like it a lot.
Awesome. Yeah, so now we have a one-stop shop for all things Weekly Stuff Podcast.
Yep, weeklystuffpodcast.com. Soon there will be 200 episodes on there.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God. If you want to start from the beginning, you can get through it in roughly 3 years of binging, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. In any case, that's my housekeeping. And, new website. I'm excited about that. What have you been up to, Sean? Any stuff separate from the other things we're going to be talking about?
I think, finishing Nier Automata and watching those Planet of the Apes movies, that was all my stuff.
Yeah.
That was a lot.
That deserves its own topics, I think. So we're going to get into that. I have a couple things of stuff to talk about.
Okay.
First off, I pre-ordered a Super NES Classic.
What? You didn't.
We'll see if it actually goes through. But you might have seen Walmart had the Super NES Classic up for about half an hour. This is not, last year's NES Classic, which is discontinued, but the new Super NES Classic that's coming out at the end of September. And they were the first Walmart was the first place to put this up for pre-order, which is nice just in and of itself, because if you remember, the NES Classic had no pre-orders. So it does seem like Super NES Classic will have pre-orders. How smooth a process that will be remains to be seen.
Yeah.
But I happened to be on Twitter when that went up. And I saw the link, and I immediately snatched one. And in the time since, a lot of people have had their orders canceled. There's been debate whether or not Walmart put it up in error.
Uh-huh.
But I will say, I have been charged for it on my credit card. The $80 has come out. Or it's in holding, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't technically take it out, but I can't spend it. So I wish they just kind of took it out, because it's weird. Because you get that thing on your bank statement of like, you have this many dollars. Awesome. But you can only spend this many.
Yeah.
Fuckers. Anyway, but so
take my money or don't, bastards.
So it's been almost a week. My Walmart order has not been canceled. I've looked online. Plenty of people's have not been canceled, but a lot of people's have been. So my guess is it's the standard internet story of they opened it and oversold.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was some kind of mistake, but they're like, we'll probably get this many. We'll keep that many orders. In any case, hopefully, I might get a Super NES Classic in. As I said before, I had no real interest in like hunting this thing down like a crazy person.
Sure.
But that opportunity did arise, and I would like to have one of these and do stuff with it when we get, you know, it comes out on release and we can talk about it on here and do other stuff. So, yeah, Super NES Classic. I was happy. I did not think I was going to get a pre-order on that.
Yes. So. We will all wait with bated breath to see if you actually get one.
Yeah, what do you think is the over-under on that actually comes to my house?
I don't know, man. I think it's probably 50-50 at this point.
Yeah, I wouldn't go any higher than that. Then I have two pieces of home video stuff I want to talk about. The first up is we had noted this like 2 months ago when it was announced, but Batman Mask of the Phantasm, one of our favorite superhero movies
yes,
here.
The best Batman movie.
It's a very good Batman movie. The movie of the original animated series from the 90s. Finally came out on Blu-ray.
Yeah, finally.
Finally. It's 2017. Blu-ray's been out for 11 years.
And all we had was that really bad DVD release.
Really bad DVD. Where it looked worse than the show itself
mm-hmm.
on that DVD. Anyway, the Blu-ray came in. This is the release date. Tuesday is when we're recording this. So the Blu-ray just came out. You can get it on Amazon and stuff. It's from the Warner Archive. And I have it in. It's very nice. I got it in kind of early this morning, so I had a chance to watch it. It's only a 75-minute movie. And I just wanted to briefly review that disc. You guys know our thoughts on the movie.
Yeah.
It's very good. I actually kind of... Every time I watch it, I forget just how radically it rethinks parts of the Batman origin
mm-hmm.
and how much it's like, we're just going to do our own thing with this movie, and I love that about it. Up to and including, the Joker might have been brutally murdered at the end of this thing.
Yeah.
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 You know.
It's an intense ending.
Yeah, it is. It's a very intense ending. But basically, you know, what you would want to know is how is the presentation of the movie on here? It's basically a bare-bones disc. It's just the film and the theatrical trailer. But there are two versions of the film. You get the widescreen version from theaters and the full-screen version, which is not cropped. It's the other way around. When this movie was in the works, it was planned as a direct-to-video thing, so they animated it in 4x3. And then for theaters, what they did is they... It's not really called cropping when you do it in theaters. It's called matting,
right.
And you take off the top and bottom. So basically you have both the theatrical presentation and the open mat. I had not watched the open mat version of this before. It looks very nice. It looks like, you know, a 4x3 movie. You see more of the animation. I actually think as the Blu-ray remaster goes, I compared them. I think it looks better in that form. Just because when you crop it and mat it, you kind of zoom in and you see some of the defects that are still there. But I thought it looked very nice. I think people shouldn't get their expectations too high. This is a, you know, somewhat lower budget animation from the 90s.
Right.
It's not going to look like a Studio Ghibli movie.
Yeah.
You know? But it looks, I think, if you're a fan of the Batman the Animated Series art style, it's a revelation to see this in, like, cleaned up quality. Because the copies of the TV show and the movie in the 2000s, at least, you know, on DVD releases have been really dirty and beat up. And this is not. It looks very pristine for what it is, and the colors come through very strong, and you get to appreciate the art style, and I love that. But the more important thing to me is actually the audio on this disc, because it's got lossless audio.
Oh.
Sounds amazing.
Nice.
Like, I did not know this movie had such a great sound mix, because that definitely didn't come through on the DVD.
Yeah.
But it sounds absolutely amazing. It's just a stereo mix, but it sounds incredible. Shirley Walker's music, which, she wrote the best Batman music.
Yeah.
I'll just say that. And it sounds so good on this. Like, I even went and listened to the soundtrack, which is on Apple Music afterwards. Doesn't sound nearly as good as it does in this new version of the movie, just in terms of how much kind of strength and depth there is to that music. So I love that. But just all the sound effects and the voices, it all comes through really powerfully. Like, it's not a surround mix, but it really does envelop you. And I was like, damn, I would not have thought this kind of low-budget Batman movie from the 90s that was intended to go direct to DVD, or direct to video, I guess,
yeah,
would have had this good and aggressive a sound mix. So... If you like Batman, if you like the animated series, if you like that voice acting, if you like that music, if you like that animation, this is something to pick up, and you should pick it up because the more people buy this, the more likely we are to get the actual TV show on Blu-ray,
yeah,
which is what I really want. Because the movie's great, but I want the TV show.
Yes. I want both.
I want both, yes, absolutely. But the movie is like, you look like this, it's good, but the TV show, there's so much of it.
Exactly.
And, you know, there's so many other villains I want to... Like, the coolest thing on the audio is I never realized how scary the Phantasm's voice is in this movie, because it is deep and terrifying, but I think that gets muffled in older copies of the movie.
Sure.
So anyway, very happy with that, and I know people were interested in that. So, and I don't think Warner sent out review copies of that or anything.
Yeah.
So we're probably one of the first people talking about this.
It's awesome. Good. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. Animated Batman on Blu-ray, that is a day we have been waiting for.
Yes, it is.
One other thing I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
I don't dive into my film academia side here much.
Sure, yeah.
Because it's even more niche than some of the stuff we talk about.
As unlikely as that seems, it is true.
Yeah. You know, I did the episode where I talked about my film school stories, but that was through the lens of comedy.
Yeah.
This is not. But I'd been talking a few weeks ago that the Criterion Collection sale was going on at Barnes & Noble, and you had asked me, Sean, like, oh, what's kind of new that you should be getting? And I didn't have a good answer to that question because I'd been buying some older stuff and I hadn't been really keeping up with this year's releases. Well, I have a good answer for that.
Okay.
Because I bought, I went back for round two and I got a second set from this sale. And it is my new favorite thing the Criterion Collection has ever released.
Jeez.
And that is I own like at least 100 spines. So
I
haven't seen every Criterion Collection, but I have some authority on this. And that is Martin Scorsese's World Cinema Project number 2.
Hmm.
And this is the second box set. The first set was released in 2013, so it's taken them a while to do another one of these. But it's called Martin Scorsese's World Cinema Project because Martin Scorsese, if you don't know, in addition to being a great filmmaker, is a truly great and passionate film historian and preservationist. And if you've been to film school or watched the documentaries or stuff, you see Martin Scorsese on documentaries about movies from every country on this planet because he is so enthusiastic and apparently finds the time to talk about them all the time. But he also runs a nonprofit called the Film Foundation, and in 2007, they created a division called the World Cinema Project to try to basically rescue movies from around the world that were on the verge of being lost or were not easily accessible. And Criterion has partnered with them for all the home video releases of these movies. A couple of them have come out as regular Criterion spines, non-box sets. Like this year they did Ousmane Sembène's Black Girl, which is also part of that project. And that was the first film by the father of African cinema. Important movie.
Yeah.
But they do these box sets too. And the first one came out in 2013. I have not seen that one. But this second one, it just had a couple of filmmakers I really like or know about on it. And I was very curious. So I thought this would be a good thing to buy during the Criterion sale. And when I say this is my favorite thing Criterion has ever put out, it's because what I love about the Criterion Collection is, like, blind buying movies. I very rarely buy from the Criterion Collection a movie I've already seen. I try to go for, like, you know, I've seen Seven Samurai, but I haven't seen Akira Kurosawa's High and Low, and I'll go for that. Or often it'll be a lot more obscure of just, this sounds interesting, or this is from a country I haven't seen their cinema before, or this is an era I haven't watched before, or, you know, when they finally started putting Charlie Chaplin out in the Criterion Collection, I was like, I actually didn't see a lot of Chaplin before now, so, and I got into that. So I love that experience of, like, discovering things, and the sense of discovery I had watching this box set was amazing. So it's 6 films from around the world. They range in dates from 1931 to the year 2000, so there's no, like, theme through the set other than these are important films by important filmmakers from around the world that are part of this film preservation effort. And I'm not going to go through all the films now. I am working on an article for the site that I want to talk about this, but this 6-film set, to a film, every single movie in the set is great. Not just good, not like historically interesting. They are great movies, and I would call at least 2 of them straight up masterpieces where I was like sitting on the couch after they ended in a daze, thinking like, that might be one of the 10, 20, 30 best movies I've ever seen. This set is out of this fucking world. And the two I'm talking about actually is, one is kind of the highlight of the set for a lot of people is Edward Yang's Taipei Story, which is the second film by Edward Yang, who was one of the important filmmakers in the new Taiwanese cinema movement, which is one of the great new waves in film history. And Taipei Story is... I was an emotional wreck after watching that movie, and it's a very quiet film, but you'd see why if you watched it. He's an extraordinary filmmaker, and that was one of his movies that was revered but hard to see, as many films of the new Taiwanese cinema movement are. And the other one, which was an even bigger surprise because I knew nothing about this or even this country's cinema, was a film by Ermek Shinarbayev, who is a Kazakhstani filmmaker. And this film is from 1989. And it's also from what is essentially a new wave, a Kazakhstani new wave, where you had all these young filmmakers who went to school in the Soviet Union at the VGIK, their film school. A lot of people did over the years. The Soviets at least gave us really good cinema. They did a lot of other horrible things.
Yeah.
They had a really good film school. So,
well, that's something.
Now, they use that film school for propaganda sometimes. But, you know, other than that.
You know, what else is film school for at the end of the day?
Yeah, it's a complex discussion.
Yeah.
Film history is scary when you actually get into it because a lot of people helped Nazis, you know, or something like that. But anyway, this is not that case because these were like the last filmmakers trained at the VGIK because the Soviet Union fell a few years later.
Right.
And Kazakhstan, part of the Soviet Union, and I think I, like most people in the world, don't know a lot about Kazakhstan. frankly, Borat is the thing that sadly sucks up so much of the conversation about that country culturally today. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Even though Kazakhstan is it's like, I think I was reading with this, it's the biggest landlocked country on Earth or something. Like, it's actually a very important country in that part of the world, obviously. And they have a pretty rich cinematic history. But this movie by Ermak Shinarbayev is called Revenge. And, oh my God, I can't recommend it enough. One of the just best film discoveries I've ever had. It's very hard to describe. It's a movie that starts in like 17th century Korea in like a Korean noble court and ends in 1945 in the Soviet Union on like an island somewhere. Okay. And in the middle tells the story of basically this revenge vendetta passed down through a generation and this very interesting spiritual journey that follows with that. And it is a film of immense visual power of its narrative truly. When you've seen as many films as I have, sometimes it's like even the best films, they don't surprise you. It's like, I know what films look like. This is a movie where consistently it's 100 minutes long. I had no idea where it was going at any point, and I loved it. It is so unique. It is about, in large part, the Korean diaspora in Kazakhstan, also something I did not know about. There was a significant link between Korea and not just the Soviet Union, but specifically Kazakhstan, and that Kazakhstan in the last years of the Soviet Union was this melting pot of a lot of people displaced by various conflicts in the Cold War. But it is a fascinating, fascinating movie. Where else are you going to see a bunch of Korean actors speaking Russian, you know? Because it's all in Russian, kind of like when we make a movie about another country, but everyone speaks English, you know? Right. So if that puts you off, it's like, that's pretty normal procedure.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a fantastic movie. There are other ones on here. There's a two-hour silent film from Brazil from 1931 called Limite, which is a full-on avant-garde film and one of the very few in the Criterion Collection, because that's one area that they don't do a lot of is actual avant-garde filmmaking. There's a movie by Apichapong Wirasathakul. He has a very long name. It's from Thailand. You might know him from the Palme d'Or winning film Uncle Boonmi, who can recall his past lives. But this is his film Mysterious Object at Noon, which is basically he goes around Thailand and with people he meets plays this the surrealist game of the mysterious corpse game or whatever that's called, beautiful corpse, I forget what it's called, but it's this idea of like extending a story or a drawing by just giving someone the last piece of the story and having them continue it. And in this movie he has all these people from around Thailand just continue this weird story, and then he dramatizes it in like fictionalized scenes. And so it's a story that starts with like the first woman who starts the story is like, oh, there's a kid and he's a paraplegic and he has a teacher who comes to his house every day. And then the next woman who continues it says, oh, and the teacher has a little marble in her purse that turns into an alien boy from space. And it goes from there. These movies in this set are so surprising and so unlike anything you've seen. I feel like I have to evangelize for this. It came out just a few months ago. It came out in May of 2017. It is one of the best box sets Criterion has ever put out. You get introductions to each film by Scorsese himself, interviews with someone very closely tied to the film on all six films, and of course one of Criterion's books full of essays and stuff.
Great.
And I just, like, it really is something I feel like I have to evangelize for, because world cinema, I love this kind of stuff. And so rarely do we get these kind of things. These are six movies that would have been so useful to me in film school just a few years ago, and now we have them on an easily accessible home format.
Right.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And if you are interested at all in kind of broadening your horizons and seeing, you know, you've probably seen films from Europe, you've probably seen films from Japan, maybe a little from South America, but that's kind of as far as a lot of people's canon goes, and that's fine, because those are the easy films to see over here.
Yeah.
But in terms of the countries this box set and some of the other things in the World Cinema Project covers, you just might not have seen these kind of things before, and this is actually a great way to start and maybe dive in, and it's got the context and the information there to help you through them, because they are challenging films. But I have to recommend that, because really, honestly, maybe my favorite thing Criterion's done.
Awesome. Yeah, that is the kind of stuff that I like Criterion for, is being able to, like, go, like, get movies that you otherwise are like, I've heard about this movie, or like, this is like by a director I really love, and I like go on their like filmography. It's like, oh, this, they have this really early movie and you can't ever see it. Mm-hmm. And then they just sort of like, you know, get those movies and bring them out. And then also providing all that context and the essays and everything. Mm-hmm. It's a really awesome, valuable thing. And it's something that, like, looking at that stuff, it makes you wish that there was something like that for, like, video games and other areas that maybe don't have a group that is so sort of dedicated and passionate at doing that stuff as Criterion is.
And no one else in the world has something like this.
Exactly.
Criterion is unique the world over. You know, British or England has like Artificial Eye and the BFI and things like that, but nothing that comes close to the breadth of the Criterion collection and the depth. And, you know, the other thing is I love when they go off the beaten path like this because as much as let's take Kurosawa as another example because they have most of his films in the collection. And I'm so glad they do because no one else would do as good a job with those. But if Criterion didn't have the license to Kurosawa, someone would put Seven Samurai out.
Right.
You know, like, we wouldn't ever live in a world where you couldn't see Seven Samurai. But no one else is putting these movies out. And that's exciting. And that's it's wonderful to me. And I just, you know, I got this set a few days ago and I watched literally everything on every disc over 5 days. And I absolutely loved it. And I've written a bunch about it. And hopefully I want to publish an article about this because I've seen some written reviews online, but not that really get into the text of the movies all that much. So anyway, that's my little home video analysis for the week.
Cool.
Yeah. You want to talk some news?
Let's talk about the news.
All right. Most of this is movie trailers and reports and things like that out of Comic-Con.
San Diego Comic-Con is still a big thing.
Yeah. I will say, I feel like less out of Comic-Con than I have in years past. Really, it was just DC and Marvel news.
Sure.
And not even any breaking stuff. But there is stuff to analyze here. We're actually going to start with something that came out a little bit before Comic-Con, but we can augment this with what came out during Comic-Con. There was another trailer for Blade Runner 2049.
Right. Yes.
And once again, I'll just say, I look at that and I'm like, Roger Deakins, the cinematographer, is painting his masterpiece here because holy fuck, that looks cool.
Yes, yeah. It is not a particularly different trailer from the other one, so I don't know if there's a lot more to say, but it's like, that movie like visually looks fucking amazing.
Yeah, and I still don't have a real feel for the story, but I actually, I still just like all the atmospherics in these trailers.
Yeah.
Like, again, the Jared Leto character who is like being a weird father/sexual figure to the replicants. Like, that's an interesting use of Jared Leto and things like that. So I am definitely psyched for this movie. But then they did have a panel about this at Comic-Con.
Yeah, Harrison Ford was there, which, like, Harrison Ford on a Comic-Con panel is not something I ever thought would happen.
Yeah, because I don't think they did one for Star Wars like that.
No, I mean, if they did, I don't think he would have been there.
And they keep those more for, like, the Disney conferences now. But yeah, they had the one, and Harrison Ford joked that he wants to bring back all his characters and was joking about, like, different romantic comedies he's done. So that was funny. They did, I guess, at Comic-Con show a little timeline of how you get from 2019, which is when Blade Runner is set, to 2049, when the new movie is set. And that was kind of cool, just looking at how they've thought of the lore of, like, what are the big things that have happened in the history of this world since, you know, Deckard ran away at the end of Blade Runner.
Right.
Spoiler. Unless you're watching the theatrical cut and he got to Canada and was happy.
Right, yes.
I don't think that's canonical anymore.
I hope that is how this new movie starts, is it starts with that shot of, like, them driving through, like, this green, beautiful countryside. You're like, where the fuck are they? How come nobody lives here? Like, why does everyone live in the desolate, fucking destroyed, neon wastes and, like, wreckages of humanity instead of moving to, like, the beautiful Italian countryside that they're in all of a sudden?
Yeah, it's so great. Yeah, anyway, maybe they'll address that, maybe not. But I thought that was interesting. Just the more I hear about this movie, it does seem like everyone involved is making a movie, not a cash-in.
Right.
And that sounds cool to me.
Yeah.
That is a film I'm excited. Like, when that movie, like, when the trailer ends and it says, see it on IMAX, that's one movie I would actually pay to go see on IMAX.
Sure, yeah.
Unless it's in IMAX 3D, but who knows? I forget if they're doing a 3D version of this.
Going to the movie theaters is a complicated thing.
It sucks.
I went to a movie theater twice in 1 month now for Spider-Man and then Planet of the Apes, and I feel dirty.
At least they were good movies.
They were good movies.
I know.
Not good theaters.
Yeah. All right. Then, moving into, let's do a block on DC stuff.
Okay, yeah.
And the DC stuff is kind of complicated because there's the stuff at Comic-Con and then two interesting reports have come out.
Yeah.
One from before Comic-Con and one from earlier today. So I'm going to go through the reports right now.
Okay, because I don't think I saw the one from earlier today.
Okay. The one from a week ago was The Hollywood Reporter had a report that DC is exploring options basically to get Ben Affleck out of Batman. And probably as a mutual thing, not like they're trying to fire him.
Yeah.
But that he probably will not play Batman again that many times. They're thinking he probably will not be the Batman in the standalone movie directed by Matt Reeves, who did the Apes movies.
Yeah.
And they're thinking of, like, not just firing him, but, like, an in-universe explanation for that somehow. I read that whole thing as, like, boy, maybe they shouldn't have started with Batman v Superman.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Like, and I will say, some of the reporting in this story I thought was a little... went a little too far. Like, one of the lines was about how, like, you know, Ben Affleck is 45 and his body isn't a temple. And
yeah.
It's like, you don't know him. Yeah. I don't know him.
That was a weird line.
He could be an alcoholic or something, but he doesn't seem like one. Like, he's, you know, he's not dead. He's 45. He could play Batman. It would be on the older side to do, like, a film trilogy with.
Right.
Because he'd be very old by the time that was done, assuming they make them in a, you know, reasonable amount of time and don't shoot them all at once or something.
Right.
But, like, yeah. So that was a little weird. But there were a lot of, you know, just points in that story where it really does reinforce, I think, how thoughtlessly the DC experiment started.
Mm-hmm.
Of, like, we're going to do our old Batman, and all he'll have fought all his villains already, and all this stuff. It's like, and then we're going to do a standalone movie. And then they get to that, and like, oh, fuck, what do we do?
Yeah.
And that really does feel like that's where they are. And, like, Matt Reeves has come in, and apparently, as you would with the guy who directed those Apes movies, they trust this guy, and he has thrown out Ben Affleck's script. He's starting from scratch with this, and I think they want him to. I think they want him to figure out a way, like, make Batman work going forward.
Yeah.
But I do suspect that might involve, like, look, I can't do this if I'm hand-tied and he's, you know, in his 50s and Batman has already fought all the villains and, like, there's no
and
story.
And we've seen him murdering people.
Right.
And, yeah, like, they kind of really... kind of, like, just burned it all up in Batman v Superman to make their weird,
yes,
edgy movie.
But it is, like, we are definitely faced with the prospect here that Ben Affleck will have been Batman in two team-up movies and never in his own movie, and they're going to have to do some weird Flashpoint stuff to get him out.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, like, an interesting report that I don't think is actually that surprising, though, when
no.
you, like, look at... I don't feel like... I even, like, seeing him at, like watching some clips from the panel at this year's Comic-Con, I just never felt like Affleck has, like, the intense enthusiasm to, like, keep that part going for, like, 10 years, you know?
I mean, he took this after Argo, and I think it's because he and Warner Brothers are very tight, and it was almost like one buddy doing another buddy a favor.
Yeah.
But I don't think either of them really thought about the long-term implications of this.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the Comic-Con panel, Ben Affleck did say, no, I'm Batman, I love it. But if you parse his words, he says nothing about being in the next movie.
Exactly. It's just like, of course he would have to say that. Like, he's not going to go up there and at the beginning of their panel be like, you saw that report, the Hollywood Reporter? It's like, yeah, I'm not going to be Batman anymore. Fuck you guys. And he just leaves and, like, never comes back. Like, that's not going to happen.
He didn't come out cosplaying as Iron Man.
No, that would have been pretty good, though.
Yeah. So he half-heartedly denied it, but not really. And it really has felt through this whole process, like, Warner's has wanted more out of Ben Affleck than he's wanted out of Batman. Like, when they kind of arm-twisted him into agreeing to direct the movie that he didn't want to direct, and then he backed out about a year later, and they arm-twisted him to writing the script that he didn't really want to be a part of, and then they tossed out the script, and it's just like, I really do think, and this is going to be a running theme through this DC section, Wonder Woman clearly has recalibrated everything they want to do over there.
Yeah.
And good. It's
the good
movie they've made. But, like, I think they looked at that movie and they looked at the movies they'd already made and been like, fuck, this isn't going to work if we try to mash these two things together going forward. You know?
Yeah. Like, can you imagine what it would be like if Wonder Woman had been the first of, like, DC cinematic movie?
I mean, it would be such a different... That would be very analogous to Iron Man in 2008, where you would just come out the door with a movie everyone loved, and you'd have complete audience buy-in from day one.
Yeah.
You know? And that's not how they did it.
No.
Because they started with a standalone Superman movie that wasn't built to be a franchise starter.
Exactly. They started with a standalone Superman movie that ends with him not really quite being Superman yet.
Yes.
And then they follow that up with a team-up movie that he's only in, like, a third of, and he dies at the end.
Yes. So, anyway, we had a DC panel at Comic-Con.
Yeah.
And I'll go to the other report later because it broke after this, but let's do the Comic-Con panel. It sounded like it was fun. I liked hearing that Ezra Miller, who plays The Flash, came on stage and he was in Edward Elric cosplay from Full Metal Alchemist. Ezra Miller is just an awesome dude. If you haven't seen his other work in movies like We Need to Talk About Kevin or The Perks of Being a Wallflower, check it out. He's a great actor. And he's one of the things I'm looking forward to in Justice League. He seems like a good Flash. And I like that he cosplays at Comic-Con.
Sure, yeah.
Anyway, but they had a panel. They showed off some things. Here's the most interesting thing to me, looking at this, is that before they showed off their big Justice League trailer, which we'll talk about, they did a reveal of their current lineup of movies.
Yes.
Let me list these.
Okay.
Okay. And these are ones that they've said this was in the reel, like, we're still working on these.
Right.
None of these have release dates, though, so keep that in mind. Shazam!
Yeah, because like I will never get over that they've had to fucking rebrand DC's Captain Marvel as Shazam, even though in the future it's probably a good move because now Marvel is making Captain Marvel more of a public thing. But I'll never be able to hear Shazam and think of that character.
And most people will not be able to hear about Shazam and think of a superhero movie because they think of a version of a basketball player genie movie that didn't exist and was actually called Kazam.
Yeah.
But most people think it's
Shazam.
Shazam. Anyway.
Wisdom of Solomon.
Suicide Squad 2. Which, oh god, who's rumored to direct that now? I'd have to look it up. I forgot to put it on the outline. Someone who I would not expect to direct this is maybe directing it. It's not David Ayer. The Batman, which they are now calling The Batman. I guess that's the title for the new movie.
Why not? You know, there are a lot of Batman movies. You need to figure out something to title it. You can't just do Batman because that was done. You can't do Batman the movie because that was also done.
Yeah.
So The Batman is one of your last remaining choices.
Justice League Dark.
Right, yes. The beginning of the Dark Universe.
Batgirl, that's the Joss Whedon one. Green Lantern Corps, because they can't just make another movie called Green Lantern in less than 10 years,
I guess. That's true, yeah. I mean, they could have called it The Amazing Green Lantern and kind of got
it. And I guess there was a hint this is going to be a different Green Lantern. I don't know that much about the lore, but they threw around the name John Stewart.
Okay, that's I don't know if he's the second, but he's one of the other Earth Green Lanterns. Okay. He's the cool one that was in the Justice League cartoon. Okay, so I think he's a lot more interesting than Hal Jordan.
Yeah, so it sounds like they're not doing... They're trying to distance themselves as much as possible from Ryan Reynolds' Green Lantern.
John Stewart is basically to Hal Jordan, the original Green Lantern, as Wally West is to Barry Allen, the original Flash. That it's like they took
Barry Allen's not the original Flash.
Well, not the original Golden Age Flash, but the original Silver Age Flash, because Hal Jordan's not the original Green Lantern either.
Okay.
But for like the original Silver Age incarnation of the characters, which is to say... That the original, like, Hal Jordan and Barry Allen are bland, nothing characters that have no personality at all, in the comics at least. I haven't watched, like, the Flash TV show and stuff. And then after that, they start being like, what if we made a version of this character that had a personality? And so then they turned Wally West, who's Kid Flash, into the Flash, and then they had, like, John Stewart and all these other people, like Kyle Rayner.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wonder Woman 2, obviously.
Yes.
It'd be really weird if they weren't doing that. Although they still have not announced Patty Jenkins to direct. It sounds like they're still working on... dotting the I's on that. I think we were all kind of hoping we'd hear that at Comic-Con, but hopefully they get her back because she's very talented at that.
Yeah, I'm also really curious just to hear what like the setting for Wonder Woman 2 is going to be.
The rumor now is like a 1980s kind of thing, like late Cold War, which we have not done in a superhero movie, so could be interesting. And then finally, Flashpoint. They announced their Flash movie, which again has gone through at least three sets of writers-directors. Is now called Flashpoint. If you don't know, that's the event that led to the new 52.
Yes.
But is also kind of commonly used now as because the Flash TV show did this too, as kind of a catch-all for a story where Flash fucks everything up with time travel.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
So that's interesting because let's talk about all the ways that's weird.
Okay, yeah.
One, it strikes me as a little weird for your first Flash movie to be the one where he fucks the continuity up.
Well, don't... Forget, we will already be intimately familiar and in love with this Flash after his appearance in the Justice League movie. So
not sure that's enough.
Justice League is like Flash number one, the same way that Batman v Superman is Superman number two.
It would just be like, to me, if you made Spider-Man Homecoming, instead of it, it's not an origin story, but instead of doing like a nice first story for this Spider-Man, you started with Black Suit Spider-Man.
Yeah, you either started with Black Suit Spider-Man or you did like the clone saga from the 80s where it's just like, there's like five Peter Parker clones and is this the real Peter Parker or is it Ben Reilly? Like, what the fuck?
So two, it's hard not to see the word Flashpoint and not think of the reports we've been getting of DC shaking things up and being like, are they going to use that just as basically a two-hour excuse to wipe the continuity and be like, wow, it's amazing, only Wonder Woman survived the Purge.
Yeah, exactly. And Batman, you look so young!
Yeah. This seems like kind of a weird strategy. I will say, the plot they had been going with for The Flash was literally just season one of the TV show, which I think would be a little soon to retread on.
Sure.
So I hope they, you know, Flashpoint or not, I'd like to see them do something a little different with that, even though I think by choosing Barry Allen, they've kind of hand-tied themselves on that, which is weird because there's a lot of Flashes you could choose from.
Yeah, there are.
But yeah, so I don't know. Flashpoint.
It just seems like a thing where it's like, I don't know why you would announce that when you don't have anything ready. Like, I don't even...
Yeah.
Do they even have a fucking screenplay for that movie yet? So it's like, all they have is a title and, like, a vague idea of probably they're going to use it to try to fix some continuity stuff and maybe recast Batman or whatever if they need to.
But that goes for almost every movie on this list. Like, yeah. This is the other thing people don't realize. Other than Aquaman, which is coming out next year, they don't have anything dated. They don't have anything ready. They don't. The closest they probably have is Batgirl and Wonder Woman 2, if only because those movies have, like, a direction or date. Right. They don't have, like, scripts yet and stuff, but they have, you know, probably some direction to go, and maybe Suicide Squad 2, because that's cast and everything. But, like, you know, Shazam has been sitting on the shelf with Dwayne Johnson. He's playing Black Adam, and that's been planned for, like, 6 years or something. But nothing's come of it. They don't have a filmmaker. They don't have a script, to my knowledge. Like, so a lot of this is weird in that, like, are we going to have a DC movie in 2020, or are they going to take several years off? I don't know.
Yeah, but at least with those movies, like, all they're saying is, we're making this movie with this character. That's all they're committing to, and then a couple of them have, like, Joss Whedon or something attached to it.
Yeah.
But the Flash one is like, we're not just making a movie with the Flash, we're making a movie with the Flash that's going to be called Flashpoint, that is going to be about time travel, and, like, blah-da-da, and, like, fucking up the continuity and all this crazy shit. It's like, how do you know that that's the movie you're going to make when you don't have, like... I would not be surprised if that never comes about. Like, if, like, by the time they do actually make a Flash movie, they realize, we can't do this. This is fucking insane. Like, that's it. That would be a hard movie to make, even if for, like, Marvel to be able to do, like, a bunch of crazy, like, multiverse time travel shit. DC has, like, barely got their feet off the ground and have only got their feet off the ground with, like, one good movie with Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
You can't just do Flashpoint right away.
No, I mean, if the Flash needs to have a supporting cast and things, you know, like... Anyway, it's bizarre. They showed a Justice League trailer. Let's talk about that in a second.
Okay.
I want to talk about the report from today, because this actually leads into this. Mashable, the website, published a report today that the Snyders, Zack and Deborah Snyder, are likely out of all future DCE work.
Okay.
Of course, they had a personal tragedy in their family earlier this year, which led Zack and Deborah to step away from Justice League and... the rewrites and stuff with that are being handled by Joss Whedon. But it sounds like they're really not planning to coming back into the fold. Zack Snyder and Deborah Snyder will have executive producer credits on a lot of these upcoming movies just because they've been in the game for a while.
Right.
But other than that, it sounds like... And they had been leading the ship. Like, that's something I think a lot of people didn't realize is that everything up to now, like, Zack Snyder was kind of playing the role of, like, Kevin Feige over at Marvel. And which was part of the problem because Kevin Feige is not a filmmaker who has day-to-day duties on other movies. Like, he can be the overall producer. This was a problem when you had the guy in the trenches making the movies also trying to see the big picture, which I think leads to a lot of the issues we've been seeing. So they're probably out. David Ayer, who directed Suicide Squad, is also unexpected to return. You'll notice that Gotham City Sirens, which is one of the things they'd been talking about for a while, like with Margot Robbie and other female heroes that David Ayer was going to direct, is not on that Comic-Con reel.
Right.
And David Ayer actually was on a panel for a different thing somewhere else at Comic-Con, and he didn't name Suicide Squad, but everyone knew what he was talking about, and he very overtly shit-talked it. Where he basically said, like, making a PG-13 studio movie sucks the soul out of you and things like that. And David Ayer has made one PG-13 studio movie.
Okay, yeah.
So it's not hard to figure out what he was talking about. So he's out. That movie's not getting made. So really, I think they are trying to keep with new talent. It's said that Geoff Johns of DC and Joss Whedon are probably steering the ship from this point on. And that the Justice League reshoots, this report also says, are really extensive. Like... Most of the action stuff Zack Snyder shot is usable, but they're redoing the plot, they're redoing a lot of dialogue, a lot of character moments. They're very heavily overhauling the movie. And maybe this is part of a plan to, you know, after the success of Wonder Woman and kind of getting a sense of what their strengths and mostly weaknesses are right now, figuring out a new direction to go. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
But I wanted to report all that before we segue into the Justice League trailer.
Yeah.
Because even if you didn't read that report... That trailer does feel like a movie that is being cobbled together second by second.
It definitely feels like a movie trailer that they had like a couple of one-liners from a few of the characters and then a bunch of the action stuff filmed and then had to make a trailer out of that.
It's not as bad as the other Justice League trailers, I thought. Like,
I guess not.
Like,
there
were moments I liked. I think Ezra Miller's Flash, I like him. I think the suit looks stupid because it looks like armor, but I think he seems like a good Flash. I think Jason Momoa looks cool as Aquaman, although he doesn't have a lot to do. And, you know, they very clearly were like, people like Wonder Woman, let's put a lot of Wonder Woman in this trailer.
Yeah.
So that was fine. You know, But yeah, other than it felt to me very messy in that you had just a lot of things that didn't coalesce together. So you had one-liners that, you know, maybe they'll work in the context of the movie, but they really felt kind of out of nowhere. They're just like, we need comedy. Comedy. Alfred, say something funny.
Alfred, do your shtick. That's the only character trait you have, is just to be sort of like old and kind of just like upset with something.
Basically, you know, directed as Jeremy Irons, channel your frustration in being in this movie.
Exactly.
And be Alfred. Yeah, that's basically it. It had a ton of action that looked big, but to me was mostly CGI barf that was incomprehensible.
Yeah, it definitely does. It just was something where, like, the whole trailer had no sense of direction or, like, focus. It did not feel like it pitched a movie to me. It felt like it showed a random assortment of scenes from a movie.
And it's a five-minute trailer.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's a long fucking trailer, and it's just like, and part of the problem is, if you're, like, comparing it to The Avengers, which is, of course, what you need to compare it to, with The Avengers, there's a very easy movie to pitch because we already know all the main characters in the movie, other than, like, Scarlet Witch and Hawkeye, I guess. Hawkeye's kind of main character in The Avengers 1.
He's not even Hawkeye for most of that movie, so...
Yeah, exactly. So we already know who... We already knew who Thor was and Iron Man was and who Captain America was. And even though we hadn't seen Mark Ruffalo Hulk, everyone knows who the fucking Hulk is, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like we already had all the... And, like, who Nick Fury was. And so you have all of that context. And you could pitch a really strong movie because everyone wanted to see these characters they liked bounce off of one another. The only character... We like in this, like, maybe some people like the Ben Affleck Batman enough from Batman v Superman to be excited by that. I'm not. But other than that, the only other character we've ever seen before is Wonder Woman. And Wonder Woman was awesome in her movie. But also, that movie was so set in World War I that there was something about seeing her in this setting, like, didn't click to me, at least it's totally out of context.
We don't know her life at this point.
Exactly. Like, if we know, like, this much younger, like, more naive Diana of the Wonder Woman movie, and we don't, like, we haven't had that time with, like, this, the sort of modern Diana or whatever that was in Batman v Superman.
And the thing is, like, it felt like that trailer was leaning on her as hard as they could in that sense of she's the one people like. But I'm guessing you can only lean on that so hard because I'm guessing the movie was not written with her as the main character.
No, it was Batman.
No, obviously. Yeah. But, and I'm sure the reshoots are, like, trying to address that, but it's not done yet, you know? Yeah. So it's like, they put in as much Wonder Woman as they could, but a lot of it is Batman growling, you know? Yeah. And okay, the weirdest thing about the entire trailer to me is the attempt to retcon Superman in this world, where you have Ben Affleck monologuing about how, like, Superman, he didn't just inspire people. He made them think they could be better. We need to believe we can be better. And it's like, you all hated him. You spent an entire movie making a ridiculously elaborate plan to brutally murder Batman, murder Superman, and in that same movie, you know what Superman was doing? Not being Superman, because he was really sad, and he was constantly asking, he was basically the Donald Trump of Superman, where he was like, okay, I became Superman, how do I stop being Superman? I hate this job. That's what was Batman v Superman. That tracked with nothing we know about these characters.
Yeah. It's like, oh man, Superman, he's like, he didn't just save people. He, like, made them see the best of themselves. I'm like, you can't say that when in your first Superman movie you ended it with him killing a fucking guy. It's like, go back to our podcast talking about Man of Steel. That's why you can't do that shit. Because you can't have your bullshit, gritty, adolescent Superman and your, like, hopeful, like, the symbol of humanity Superman. They can't coexist. You can't fucking do that. So when you try to pitch that in your fucking trailer, it just makes me roll my eyes.
And we're not the only people pointing this out. Like, it's so obvious in Man of Steel and Batman v Superman. Whether you like those movies or not, if you like them, I'm surprised you're still listening to this podcast, but it's okay. You can. Just, you might get annoyed.
Yeah.
Whether you like them or not, those movies pitch a version of Superman who is reluctant, who does not like going out and being Superman, who does not really inspire the public because they hate him. That's a recurring theme in Batman v Superman. And who is so non-established that they call him the Superman.
Uh-huh.
Which sounds very... It's like when your, you know, aunt calls you about the Wi-Fi. Or the internet.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, auntie, just call Best Buy.
It's just Superman. It's just Superman. And no, there's not a space. It's just one word. It's just Superman.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ.
Superman, one word, no space. Spider-Man, there's a hyphen.
Exactly.
It's pretty easy.
Yeah.
You can remember him. No. Yeah, so, like, that was the most ridiculous part. But it does make me wonder, like, I'm guessing that was not in the original script.
Probably not. Hopefully not.
Because Zack Snyder hates Superman.
Yeah.
We know that. But, like, is this an attempt? Do you think in Justice League they're going to try to, like, retcon Superman and this world as much as they possibly can? And if so, do you think that can work?
I think they'll... It seems like they're going to try. Because it seems like you have to try to do it. I don't think it's going to work, no. Because it's the other, like, ridiculous part of the trailer is the fact that Superman is dead from the end of Batman v Superman, like, supposedly. But remember, the end of Batman v Superman shows the fucking pebbles or whatever lifting off the grave, because obviously Superman wasn't dead. So you have that ridiculous thing at the end of the trailer where Jeremy Irons' Alfred is just like, he said you would come, and, like, looking at the camera, and you get, like, this hint of, like, a vaguely red something in the corner of the frame. It's like, well, yeah, of course Superman's... Like, it just feels like you so fucking shot yourself in the foot by killing Superman at the end of the last movie that you have to sort of tease his return in your trailer. It's just like, just again, don't kill him.
Again, I don't think any of us have fully reckoned with how weird it is that there is the first Justice League movie ever is coming out, and Superman is not in a single marketing material.
Yeah, like, they had that really cool, like, this is the best thing coming out of Justice League so far, was that cool Alex Ross-style poster from Comic-Con that, yeah, of, like, the pictures of all the actors that kind of looks like that, like, Kingdom Come-style, like, really realistic painting stuff that Alex Ross, the comic book artist, does. And that looks really cool, but you're like, Superman's not on there. What the fuck? Like, it's Justice League. Like, there's three people that you need to have for it to be the Justice League, in my opinion, and that's Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, and they only have two out of those three people, and I never would have guessed that the one that wouldn't have been there was Superman. I would have always assumed if there was one of those three that would not have been in a Justice League movie, it would have been Wonder Woman.
Yeah, because Hollywood is weird.
Exactly, but
no, it's
they're
Superman.
Weird in a weirder way now,
they are. It's bizarre. It's just weird that Superman... It's not like there isn't precedent for this. Let me give a good example. You remember the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie?
Vaguely, yes.
Dead Man's Chest.
Yes, Dead Man's Chest.
At the end of that movie, Jack Sparrow dies.
Right, yes. Yeah, yes. Because then at the beginning of the next one, he's like in Weirdo Land in a bottle, yeah, or some shit.
Right, and they basically do the Return of the Jedi thing.
Yes.
Did the trailers to Pirates of the Caribbean 3 at World's End try to not have Johnny Depp in them?
No,
he was on. He was on every poster. He was in every trailer, and the trailers just kind of gave you, like, yeah, here's how we're going to bring him back. They didn't play those games. They were just like, yeah, we could be cute about this, but people are coming to this movie for Jack Sparrow. We're not going to pretend we killed him. You know, mm-hmm. Like, that's stupid, and it's equally stupid here. Like, even if you killed Superman, that doesn't prevent you from showing something of him in the movie. And no, I don't think Superman is the main draw of this Justice League because Henry Cavill is an awful Superman. But, like, it's just weird. Like,
yeah.
You know, if I have any residual excitement for this, it is always muted by, like, that doesn't look like the Justice League to me because the ostensible leader isn't there.
Exactly.
It's, again, it would be like if the first Avengers came out and Cap wasn't there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like there's just this weird sort of America-shaped hole in the team. You, like, yeah, can't quite picture, like, how it can exist without him.
And the thing that worries me is that if they really are being this cute about it, does that mean Superman's in 10 minutes of this movie at the very end?
I'm kind of willing to bet that he's in most of the movie and they're, yeah, just, like, trying to cut around him. That,
interesting.
Like, I don't know. Because, yeah, another part of the trailer, because this is, it was maybe the most hilarious thing about the trailer to me, was reading, like, some of the comments. I think I was, like, on, like, the one of the Reddit subreddits and looking at the comments of people responding to the trailer, because I'm curious about what people take away from this stuff. And everyone was talking about, there's, like, one line in the trailer where the villain says, like, no Green Lantern or whatever. It's like, which was just kind of a weird line to have, like, you didn't set up Green Lantern to this universe yet. And most people, like, most people don't know what the fuck Green Lantern is. You can't just assume that knowledge on the part of the audience. You know that, DC? You know that, Warner Brothers? Because nobody saw your fucking Green Lantern movie. It's like, you can't just throw Green Lantern out there and assume that people know what you're talking about other than it's a dude with, like, a green ring.
It'd be like if, again, going back to Avengers 1, they had marketed the Thanos appearance.
Right,
you know, like, no one knew who Thanos was.
Exactly. So they're just like, no Green Lantern. But then, because that line was there, it set everybody off to be like, what if the person that shows up at the end of the trailer is Green Lantern? I'm like, what are you talking about? What do you mean, what if it's Green Lantern? Of course it's not Green Lantern. Then nobody's cast as Green Lantern. DC, like, Warner Brothers has never fucking said anything about making, like, new Green Lantern other than, I guess, this Green Lantern Corps movie that's going to come out in 2025 or whatever. Like, it's Superman! Are you fucking crazy? Of course, it's obviously Superman!
The best discussion point I heard about this, it was a joke, was like, maybe it's Bizarro Superman, and then we'll get, you know...
I mean, but the sad truth of that is we've already gotten Bizarro Superman twice, and maybe that's how they retcon it. Maybe that's what we find out, is we've never actually seen this universe as Superman. It's only been Bizarro Superman the whole time.
Yeah, I don't... Have you heard the best story from the reshoots of Justice League yet?
No.
Okay. So, the Justice League reshoots are going on so long, they're going on longer than the cast expected. And Henry Cavill is also in the next Mission Impossible movie.
Right, okay.
And in the next Mission Impossible movie, he has a mustache for his character. And he is having to go back and forth shooting both movies, but he can't shave the mustache because he needs it, like, for continuity and everything for Mission Impossible. So he's shooting as Superman with the mustache on Justice League.
And they're just going to, like, edit it out and post.
They're going to CGI out the mustache, and apparently it is something of a budgetary nightmare because it's going to take a ton of work.
I feel like at some point you just, like, get Joss Whedon in a room and say, Joss, I know this is going to be hard. We need you to do this. We need you to find a way to work the mustache into the movie. I mean, it's not unheard of when Superman... I mean, not specifically the mustache part, but when Superman came back to life in the 90s after the Death of Superman story arc, he came back with a mullet. So, you know, sometimes it happens. Sometimes, you know, Superman has different phases of life and sort of, you know, hairstyles he moves through after he is resurrected. Maybe in this continuity, he just decides he's going to rock a stash.
Here's what I hope. There needs to be a version of the movie on the Blu-ray where he has the mustache. I don't care if I liked the movie or not. I'll buy your DVD if it has the mustache cut of Justice League.
Oh, that'd be so good. And not just, but actually, like, the reverse of, like, don't just have Superman with the mustache, but then digitally add mustaches onto all the other characters. So it's like Wonder Woman has a mustache, Batman has the mustache. Flash has a mustache, but it's hard to see, but you can kind of see some bristles coming out of, like, the bottom
of the mask. He has, like, a handlebar one that, like, comes out and, like a
Spidey whiplash. Yeah, it pops out from under the mask and then, wraps around.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, let's move on. Marvel stuff.
Marvel.
Marvel had some cool announcements. Yeah. Black Panther continues to sound awesome. They had a big panel with all the people, and it just sounds like they had so many cool things to say. And the poster they released for Black Panther is a really cool poster.
Yeah, it is.
So, look at that. They talked about Captain Marvel, which is... Brie Larson's playing Captain Marvel.
You mean Shazam, Jonathan? Captain Marvel, that was like 2010, man.
That movie is being directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck and being written by... I forget her name, but she wrote the original draft of Guardians of the Galaxy 1. So she's worked with Marvel before. Sounds like they got a cool team there. And Captain Marvel is going to be set in the 1990s.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be kind of an origin story before Iron Man, but obviously after, like, you know, the first Avenger, but earlier than some of the other Marvel films, and then we'll see what she's been doing in the meantime. We will see her in Infinity War Part 1 first, but then she'll have her origin story movie before Part 2. So that's kind of neat.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so Captain Marvel, that's going to be cool.
Yeah.
They also had some, like... They haven't shot the movie yet, but they did have some concept art of, like, what Brie Larson would look like in the costume and stuff, and it looked neat. So, I'm excited they're doing that. Ant-Man and the Wasp, they also showed off a little bit of. They are shooting that movie right now. I guess they showed some footage that included Ant-Man as giant man hiding between two skyscrapers or something.
Okay, that's good.
Which is great. And they also announced that Michelle Pfeiffer, Catwoman herself, has joined the cast as Janet Van Dyne, mother of Hope Van Dyne, the original Wasp. That's cool.
Yeah.
I love we've got this, like, thing of, like, the original Batman Tim Burton actors coming back to be characters in modern superhero movies. So you got Michael Keaton coming up. You got Michelle Pfeiffer. We need Danny DeVito to do something in one of these. Jesus. You know, Jack Nicholson doesn't act anymore, but
Danny DeVito should just be the Penguin in the new Batman movie. Just, like, roll it in.
Okay, that's the other. Going back to Justice League for just a second.
Okay,
they made a Penguin reference in that movie. Or in that trailer?
Yeah.
No fucking way Ben Affleck's Batman fought the Penguin. And if he did, he, like, disemboweled him or something.
Yeah, I mean, he murdered him and, like, threw him into, like, an ice-cold pond or something and let him freeze.
It's just, I don't want to even imagine that. Anyway, so Ant-Man and the Wasp, all of that sounds cool. But.
Yeah.
The coolest thing they showed was the new trailer for Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Look, we talk about a lot of movie trailers, and we get excited about some of them. And we're frequently excited for Marvel movies. But on the merits of a trailer alone, I have never been this excited for a Marvel movie.
Uh-huh.
Thor Ragnarok looks like a comic book orgasm come to life.
It's amazing. It is fucking insane how good that trailer is. Like, the first Thor Ragnarok trailer was really good. This one is, like, amazing.
Let's start at the end with what will surely be your favorite thing. Hulk talks!
Yes, talking Hulk. Finally, our long national nightmare is over. The people at Marvel's film are like, wait, doesn't Hulk talk in a bunch of the comic books? And doesn't that make him a way more interesting character when you can actually have, like, you know, sort of communicate the differences between Hulk and Bruce Banner in a way that's more than just, rawr! And like, oh yeah, they did do that all the time in some of the cartoons of the comic books. Maybe we should do that in our fucking movie. It's, I guess it's the third Hulk appearance, and finally, third/fourth, depending on how you count the Edward Norton movie. But
you don't. Yeah. That's kind of the answer
but
now.
But finally, Mark Ruffalo gets to get in the booth and say something as Hulk that's not just beauty god or whatever. Which was great, but I want a somewhat more articulate Hulk, and that's what we get in this trailer.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. There are two scenes of Thor talking to Hulk, one as Hulk, one as Bruce Banner.
Yeah.
And they are both so great. The one early on where he's talking to Bruce Banner, he's like, oh yeah, we fought. I won. It was easy. And Bruce Banner's like, oh, that doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
That looks so good. You've got Loki in there, who has been assumedly doing Loki things.
Yeah.
And he and Thor have to team up again, because that's always the best. It's just great. I want more of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's just that unbelievable shot of them both with, like, these fucking, like, 80s, like, sci-fi laser rifles just firing them down the hallway with, like, neon lasers. It's very good.
Oh, that's so great. And the best thing to me about this trailer and the last one is Cate Blanchett as Hela, or whatever her name is.
It's Hela.
Best movie villain ever. We haven't seen the movie. I wasn't even sure what her name is. I'm calling it. It's so great.
She, like there's only, I think, one shot in the trailer of her not wearing the crazy headdress thing, the Jack Kirby nonsense on her head. And, like, so, which hopefully means that ratio maintains for the movie, that there's, like, a couple, because you need a couple of scenes or a couple of shots of her without it on, so that the contrast happens when she's fucking walking outside with these giant black spike things protruding from her head. You're like, this shit is real.
I mean, it really does feel like Oscar winner legend Cate Blanchett came ready to play. Like, she's not doing a cash-in. She's like, no, make it more ridiculous.
Yeah, like, she looks like she's having the time of her fucking life in every single frame in that trailer. And it's the best thing in the world.
It looks so good. But then in general, like, the visuals in this movie also look incredible.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people have been making the Guardians of the Galaxy comparison, and I get it to a certain degree. I also think what we're seeing here is way more, like, fantasy-oriented, way more colorful, way more otherworldly than Guardians, which you get a little bit of that, but it is, you know, a space, you know, movie with the space civilizations and stuff. This is Norse mythology craziness.
Yeah, this is, like, the crazy space fantasy of the Marvel Norse mythology. Yeah, that's, like, it has, because I can see the touches of, like, the weird sort of 80s sci-fi stuff that they have in the trailer. But it is, like, as you say, it's infused with this, like, heavy metal Norse goodness that just, like, really makes the whole thing sing.
Yeah, it really does just look visually absolutely stunning. And if you want to compare CGI in modern movies, look at the Justice League trailer.
Uh-huh.
It looks like nonsense.
Yeah.
Look at this. That looks like art. Like, the CGI used in the Thor Ragnarok trailer, and there's a ton of it, makes for some beautiful images. Like, my little brother has a 4K monitor on his computer, and we watched it on that, and it just looked so good. Like, every frame of it. I just can't wait to, like, sit and soak in this movie.
Yeah.
I think if you had told me coming into this year, all right, we're getting Guardians 2, we're getting a new Spider-Man movie, and we're getting another Thor, which one's probably going to be the best? I don't think I would have guessed Thor. But it really seems like that's the path we're on. And those other two were great.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, if Thor Ragnarok is the movie that they are selling to us in these trailers, I think it's going to be something real special.
And I love the whole idea, like, Thor's like, the end of days is coming, we got to make a team.
Yeah.
And so he's got Loki, and he's got the Hulk, and he's got the Tessa Thompson character. Yeah. I don't know who that is, but she looks cool. Everything in this trailer just looks cool.
All have to go fight Cate Blanchett, who's just completely out of her goddamn mind.
The music in this trailer is amazing.
Yeah.
I love the way they score it. And that last shot of Hulk just basically jumping into a giant Ragnarok god or something. Yeah. Oh, he looks so good.
It looks really fucking good. God. Yeah, because that was like the story of that day, of like halfway through the day or whatever, the Justice League trailer came out, and you watch it, and you're like, I guess that's okay. And then later, like a couple of hours after that, the Thor Ragnarok trailer dropped, and you're like, okay, no, this is a good trailer. This is something fucking crazy.
Two other pieces of Comic-Con stuff. Okay. Also with Marvel at some point, they did a trailer for The Defenders, the Netflix show.
Right.
It looked okay. I mean, are you excited for this?
I'm excited, yeah. Like, okay. I haven't decided to try to watch the Iron Fist show or not, because it did not get very good reviews. But
to put it mildly.
Yeah. But, you know, I really like the other three shows a lot.
Yeah,
I want to see Daredevil and Jessica Jones, because I think those two characters,
yeah,
and their personalities would be a lot of fun to bounce off each other.
I still haven't caught up on Luke Cage, so I wouldn't want to watch this without watching Luke Cage, just because I've heard it's very good and I love that character. It does seem interesting. It does feel like, boy, they made a miscalculation in putting Iron Fist last, because that sapped, I think, so much enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Like, imagine if you went from Luke Cage into this, and people loved that show. I feel like you'd be riding more of a high into it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I also thought, like, again, I haven't seen a ton of Iron Fist, but from what I've seen, like, it seems like they're probably making better use of Iron Fist in the team setting than probably on his own, because you can kind of undercut and have fun with it or whatever. But yeah, I mean, I'm interested to see what this is. It seemed like it's going to be another story where they fight the Hand, and this will be the third full season of a Marvel show that is fighting the Hand, and at a certain point, maybe you have to have a different villain.
I'm hoping that, because it looks like they're just sort of paying off of a huge amount of the stuff that was set up by the end of Daredevil Season 2, and so my hopes are, honestly, mostly that, like, all that stuff is taken care of in The Defenders, and so if they make Daredevil Season 3, it doesn't have to deal with that shit.
I agree, because the end of Daredevil Season 2 is the worst stretch of Daredevil, so, like, it's interesting. But, no, I did like seeing the characters together, and it reminded me, like, right, Charlie Cox and Kristen Ritter, I love in those roles, and I forget the guy, who plays Luke Cage?
Oh, geez.
Mike Coulter?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
He's great. So it's going to be interesting. That drops way sooner than I thought. That's August.
Yeah, that does feel like that just snuck up on us.
So I don't know when I'll find time to, because that's the other thing, is these shows are so fucking long.
Uh-huh.
Like, I want to watch Luke Cage, but it's 13 solid hours, and it's like, there's a lot of TV on right now. And it's perpetually, that's just an always true statement now.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, that's not as much as a Twin Peaks, but it's still a lot of TV.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then we did have a Doctor Who panel.
Yes, we did.
Which was neat. Peter Capaldi got a full-on standing ovation.
Yeah.
And the images from that were sweet, and I liked that. And everyone was there, and I thought everyone had cool things to say, and they did show a little one-minute teaser for the Christmas special, which is now called Twice Upon a Time.
Yeah, so I guess breaking the tradition, Stephen Moffat, what are you doing?
And it's just...
the Doctor story should have the Doctor somewhere in the title.
If you're not going to call it Twelfth Night, at least come up with a good title. Twice Upon a Time, that's literally the title of a Mickey movie. Mickey's Twice Upon a Christmas.
Well, that is not literally the title of a...
It's very close.
It's very similar to the title of a Mickey movie.
Anyway, it looked very good, though.
It did, yes. I'm really, really excited.
Looks great. And two notable things.
Yeah.
Mark Gatiss is in this episode. His first time on screen in Doctor Who, to my knowledge.
I think he was the guy in that... there's a David Tennant, the Lazarus experiment or whatever.
He's in that.
Extraordinarily forgettable episode of Doctor Who.
Yes.
I was only reminded that it existed because I saw a comment saying that, like, oh, this is his only time other than that one.
Okay, well, anyway, we all like Mark Gatiss as an actor, maybe a little more than as a writer, but he looks very good in that part, whatever it is.
I suspect he's probably playing some sort of ancestor for the Brigadier, is my guess. Because it looks like it's World War I.
Right, I thought that too, and I'm like, well, that wouldn't fit with him being the Brigadier, but he's got the stash and everything.
Yeah, I could see him being the Brigadier's dad or granddad.
I'd love that.
Yeah.
And then they would have a new version of that to kind of bring back if they ever had to. But yeah, so that sounds fun. And they show at the end of the trailer, Bill will be in this episode, Pearl Mackey.
I'm curious to see what capacity, like how that's going to work, because they gave her a very good send-off at the end of the last season. So I'm curious. There are a lot of avenues where you could fit her in and do stuff with her. So I'm curious.
I'm curious too. She's a great character. I'm happy to see her again. I think we're both kind of feeling like she probably shouldn't be the companion going forward just because her story felt like it wrapped up.
Yeah.
And Pearl Mackey on stage seemed to indicate that. Like, she kind of talked in the past tense about her time on the show.
Yeah.
Matt Lucas did the same thing as Nardole. To have her... I mean, if for no other reason than... most of the time you want someone there with the Doctor when he regenerates, you know? Mm-hmm. And I would want that with Peter Capaldi too, and Bill and him, you know, that it would be good for her to be there or something, yeah. You know, if that's what they're thinking of. Because it worked when David Tennant was alone in his last scene, but that also, you know, increased the sadness of that moment, like, exponentially.
Right.
And made a lot of people unable to let go. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I am curious to see what's going on with that, but I cannot wait to Christmas.
Yes.
That's going to be the best Christmas present any of us get.
Yeah, it is pretty mind-bending seeing Peter Capaldi and David Bradley, with David Bradley and his first Doctor get up. It is just sort of like fucking crazy.
And like, because he's the first Doctor, I feel like, and you get a little sense of this, that like, he's not used to meeting himself yet.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And like, because every other Doctor, they're pretty jaded to it at this point. Like, I went back and watched some scenes from the 50th special, and I love that 10 and 11, it does not faze them one bit.
They have been through way weirder shit than that. Yeah. Yeah.
They're just like, oh, cool, you have a bow tie now. But no, like, he would be like, you're the how many-th Doctor is what we're probably going to get.
Yeah. Like, technically, it's a new regeneration, so it's a whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it. I cannot wait.
Yeah.
All right. So that's all the Comic-Con news. Anything else from that?
I don't think so. All
right. One last piece of news. Yesterday, Eon Productions announced that the 25th James Bond film, they are making it. It's because they are no longer working with Sony and they've been looking for a new distributor.
Right.
I'm not sure how that has even settled out, but they have confirmed they're making the 25th Bond movie. It is coming November of 2019, so it's got a release date that will be 4 years after Spectre, which means we've had a couple of 4-year James Bond gaps recently, which is weird for that series. Normally it's 2-year gaps. Now, the press release does not confirm who is playing James Bond in this, but the New York Times... pretty reputable, unless you're a certain president.
Sure.
Has reported that Daniel Craig is going to return. They just haven't like dotted the I's on that yet. But that is the idea, is that Daniel Craig will be in this. And I breathe a sigh of relief at that, because Daniel Craig is a great James Bond, but Spectre is a terrible James Bond movie, and it would be very sad if that was his last one. So I hope they can kind of maybe right the ship.
Yes.
Because, look, James Bond has gone off the rails plenty of times.
Yeah.
You can... like, whenever people despair about James... like, Spectre killed the series. I'm like, look, if it survived... Die Another Day. Or if it survived Octopussy, where he's a clown. Like, it can survive anything.
Yeah.
James Bond's gonna be okay.
Yeah, it may take a couple of extra years... to find itself again. But yeah, I don't think James Bond is stopping anytime soon.
Yeah, so hopefully Daniel Craig, and I would imagine this will be his last movie. That's good. Get another one with Daniel Craig. I am interested to hear who is going to be directing this. The writers are Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, who have written every James Bond movie since the second Pierce Brosnan film. This will be their 8th film.
Yeah, that's
a lot. If I'm doing my math right, and I might not be, but they have written all of them, or at least co-written them. And it's funny because along the way, like... I think Casino Royale, they said, that's our last one. And then Quantum of Solace, like, they were brought back kind of because that movie had a troubled production. Like, okay, but that's our last one. And then Skyfall, they're like, this is the 50th anniversary. It's Skyfall. It's really good. That's our last one. And then Spectre, they wrote that one. And they're like, we're not going to do it again. So, like, they just keep bringing those guys back. And to be fair, I think their track record is more hits than misses. But they will be writing it. But we have no word on director. So we'll see what they do with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When did Casino Royale come out? Was that, like...
2006.
Yeah, geez.
So,
Will have been Bond for like 13 or 14 years.
He will by far have the longest tenure in terms of years. Roger Moore will have more movies.
Yeah.
But Bond will, Craig, if he actually does this one, even if he doesn't, I think like at this point he has a ridiculously long tenure in the role. Just, 9 years from Casino Royale to Spectre.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a lot of years and a lot of weird gaps in there because of different things. So, but yeah, I hope he does one more and then they can find a new Bond. But I would be sad if, because the ending of Spectre also is really weird and stupid. So have you seen that one yet?
Nope. Okay. I've only watched Casino Royale and Skyfall of the Daniel Craig movies. So I feel like I've got a good track record on picking my winners.
See, if they do a third good one, we have a solid trilogy.
Yeah.
And we can ignore the off number ones.
There you go.
Although Quantum of Solace isn't nearly as bad as people say it is. That one's just fine.
Okay. But, maybe I'll check that out one day.
It's worth watching because it's them very much trying to do a Jason Bourne movie, and I think it's fascinating. If for no other reason than Daniel Craig is good in that mode of like just murdering people brutally all over the place.
Right.
That's the kind of Bond he is.
Yes.
You know, he'd be a good DC Batman.
Maybe that's what they're going to do.
Yeah.
If they're going to decide to recast an older actor playing Batman with another older actor playing Batman.
Indeed. All right. Let's talk about some movies.
Okay.
I want to start with Dunkirk, because it just came out. You have not seen it, right?
No, I have not.
But I did see this the other night. I got to see a 35mm screening, which was cool. And I just reflect on the fact that 35mm has not even been gone a decade, and now it's a special thing when we get to see it, and that makes me sad.
Right.
But anyway, saw Dunkirk. It's a very good movie.
Cool.
People are talking about it. I don't have any real disagreements with what's going on. I don't know if I quite am at the level of love it that a lot of people are at. I respect the hell out of this movie. I think it is an incredible technical achievement. And, you know, if we're thinking in terms of Oscar nominations, for instance, this should have across the board in, like, every technical category. Chris Nolan as director, Hoyte van Hoytema for cinematography. It is a real technical feat. And, you know, I saw this with my brother, and when we got out, he said, like, that is a movie that is good on every level. And I agree. Like, it excels at everything it sets out to do. It's an interesting movie because it takes this, you know, big famous war event, the evacuation of Dunkirk, and it's completely non-conventional. Because normally you would expect that kind of movie to be, like, 3.5 hours long and have a million characters and really go into all the nitty-gritty, you know, kind of the Saving Private Ryan model or something. And that's not what Dunkirk is. It's 100 minutes long. It's by far Chris Nolan's shortest movie since Following, which is his 70-minute student film, which you should see. Cause it's very good.
Cool.
But anyway, so it's like his shortest movie. It has a pretty small handful of characters, even though the evacuation of Dunkirk was 400,000 soldiers. And it does a good job at various points of, I think, conveying the scale, but for the most part, it's very narrow on what it chooses to follow. It does not do anything before the crisis started. It shows very little of the follow-up. It is not focused on the larger context of this in the war. It's just like, there's a military crisis. If we don't get these people off the beach, Hitler probably wins because England doesn't have an army anymore. And, you know, one of the strands is you follow a soldier as he basically escapes this little French town, gets to the beach, and you follow him from, you know, that point to when he is safely away from Dunkirk. And that's kind of one of the threads of the movie. So it's very, very focused. And it's focused to the point where the movie also does something interesting with time, where it tells three intercutting stories. One is on what's called the mole, which is this little thing on the beach where they had all the soldiers stationed while they were trying to wait for evacuation. And that takes place over 1 week. And then there's a story that takes place on a little boat, one of the little ships of Dunkirk, as they called them, where basically fishermen and just, you know, the citizens of England who had boats brought their boats to Dunkirk to get all the soldiers away because they'd be easier to get there than war fleets and stuff.
Right.
And so you follow a character played by Mark Rylance and some other people on his boat as they get to Dunkirk, and that takes place over 1 day. And then you have in the air, you have 1 hour, and this is with the Tom Hardy character who plays a fighter pilot as he is trying to give air support over Dunkirk during the evacuation. And all these stories are cut together, and it is one of the most fascinating and impressive feats of editing I have ever seen. Like, this movie will be taught in film school for editing forever, and it should be. It is that is the one Oscar. If this does not win that, that's ludicrous. And that's already Chris Nolan has had a couple movies where I feel like his editing obviously should have won an Oscar, like Inception and things like that,
right,
and wasn't even nominated. His editor Lee Smith is out of this world talented. But what Dunkirk winds up doing is it's got this really interesting sense of time dilation, where you have one story going on over a week, one over a day, one over an hour, but they're all cut together. And so you have this really interesting study in Chris Nolan is using, like, this emotional kind of, you know, almost Soviet montage style of editing to give you this sense of the shared experiences, but he's not using editing in a normal continuity sense for time. Like, everything is moving forward, but it's not always moving in straight lines, and you might have, there's a great sequence near the end of the movie where you have a couple characters across the three stories in mortal peril, and they're all on the verge of dying, and bad things are happening, and you kind of have to take a step back and say, right, none of this is happening at the same time. He's just cutting it that way, and it's a very interesting study in that, and that it really plays with your mind, I think, in interesting ways of, like, you expect through the language of film editing, when you cut from one place to another, you're saying, like, this is happening sequentially.
Right.
And it's not, but emotionally it is. So it's very interesting. I think it's absolutely an evolution of what he's done with time in Inception and in Interstellar, those two movies particularly. But this in a more historical, you know, kind of down-to-earth fashion. The cinematography in the film is just jaw-dropping. I don't know how they did it. I do not know how they did it. The stuff in the sky, particularly with the Tom Hardy character, who is amazing in this movie, by the way. It's the second Tom Hardy performance in a Chris Nolan movie where he has a mask on the entire film and yet gives a massively good performance because he is just an actor of such quiet detail. He also did that in Mad Max.
Yeah, exactly.
He's a great actor. But anyway, all the stuff in the sky, they basically just mounted an IMAX camera to an old fighter plane and had someone fly around and get those images. And it's why, if you can, see this movie on film, because digital will not be able to show, I think, the fine gradations of color and texture you see in the movie on the sky horizon and in the water and all that. Like, that kind of play with light is something, you know, physical film stock is still uniquely good at. And that would be lost a little bit if you saw it digitally. Not that it's still worth seeing. If you can only see it digitally, yeah, I'm not going to get into, like, there's only one true way to see Dunkirk.
Right.
See the movie. It's a good movie. You'll like it. But that's an incredible thing about it. And just, you know, this is another of Chris Nolan's movies where I'm sure there's CGI in it somewhere, but it looks like a movie they could have made in some ways in 1945, because it's just, they're out there practically doing these things. And that's amazing. Like, it definitely does have a feeling of, like, a Howard Hawks movie or something. I thought of, like, Only Angels Have Wings and some films from that era that do some of this kind of stuff. So, anyway. And then the sound design. My brother is a composer and does some sound engineering stuff, and he said it might be the best sound design he's ever heard in a movie, and he could be right. It is absolutely tremendous sound design, and the way Hans Zimmer, the composer, mixes his score in with the sound design to the point where it's virtually impossible to tell what is score, what is sound, and it all mixes together in a way that just pushes you through this movie as this incredible technical experience. I love all of that. There's one sequence in particular where this soldier is on the beach and the Germans are dropping bombs, and the bombs are coming closer and closer and closer to him, and it's the loudest I've ever heard, like, a theater shake, and then the bombs stop right before it gets to the kid, and you feel like that kid shit his pants. You know, like, that would be the scariest thing on earth. But yeah, it's really interesting. I think, you know, the movie, I can't put my finger on anything I dislike too much about the movie. I think some of the writing in terms of dialogue here and there, and there's not a lot of dialogue, most of the movie is silent in terms of dialogue, is a little on the nose or hackneyed in some places. And I think some of the choices characters make, I don't quite get. And some of that is the movie is just so dense with detail, I need to see it a second time to see, like, how did they get from point A to point B? Like, there's this whole little episode where they're on a ship. And I know they're on the ship because it's a beach ship and they're trying to wait for it to get to high tide and take them away. But, like, the whole thing is kind of predicated on characters making kind of weirdly bad decisions. And so some of that bothered me a little bit. And I don't think the movie has, for me, quite, like, the emotional impact that I've seen some people report. But I do see why people have said that. And if nothing else, as I said, it's a technical accomplishment. And, you know, to go to a historical war epic in this day and age and come out saying, I've never seen someone do this genre like that, you don't say that. That never happens. War movies are so codified, and Chris Nolan found a way to do this in a fashion no one else has ever done before, and it is worth seeing, and worth seeing on the biggest screen possible. It's a really cool experience. So,
awesome. Yeah. Yeah, that playing with the sort of the time stuff sounds the most interesting to me, because I really like when filmmakers are able to sort of play with cinematic language in such a way where, like, to kind of defy your expectations and to sort of make you realize that, like, right, you are taught to watch a movie and the movie is, like, presenting you this, like, linear series of events that you just assume are all happening right after one another, and they're just representing that sort of, like, straight series of time. Other than when there's an occasional flashback that is, like, very deliberately sort of key to you in some, like, specific way. And I like, that was one of the things I liked about Mulholland Drive, is just playing with the sense of, like, space and time and ways of, like, realizing you can do things in a movie that if you watched a play, for instance, you wouldn't be able to do, because a play actually has to be in real life. Movies don't have to be real life. You can play with it however you want, and that's cool.
And Chris Nolan's commitment to it here is really interesting to me, because it's easy to say that the timelines converge at the end, but only kind of. Like, it's interesting how he plays with that. Like, they converge, and then he continues dilating through to the end, which I find in really interesting ways. Like, the kind of the resolution of the Tom Hardy character. If you've seen it, you know what I'm talking about. I love how he cuts that at the end. So, yeah, it's all of that is fascinating, and yeah, Chris Nolan uses his powers for good. He has the clout to make whatever the fuck he wants for the rest of his life, and generally I think he's used it for good, so that's awesome.
Yeah, he never seems like he just sort of, like, takes an easy movie. He definitely is always, he's swinging for it.
Yeah, and even when, you know, like, we don't love The Dark Knight Rises, that's a movie. Like,
sure, yeah.
Everyone on that movie tried real fucking hard.
Yeah.
And it comes up short in some areas, but it's a movie, goddammit. And
yeah.
Sometimes that's rare at Warner Brothers these days.
Sure,
so anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's Dunkirk. But you've seen Planet of the Apes. You guys know what I think about it. You saw the whole trilogy.
Yeah.
What'd you think?
I really like those movies a lot. Yeah, they're... I think the thing that for me that I like the most about them is that definitely they have this feeling of, like, of how I feel when I watch, like, King Kong or a Ray Harryhausen movie or some of the movies from the 80s, of, like, almost like a Labyrinth or maybe, like John Carpenter's The Thing. Those movies from, like, their era where, like, they're special effects movies, you know? Mm-hmm. They're the kinds of movies that's, like, to me, the most remarkable thing and, like, the thing I, like, latch onto the most is, like, the special effects and how they're achieved and what they do. Which is not to say that, like, the movie has, like, bad characters or writing or anything like that. Like, all that stuff is great also. But to me, it's, like, watching all three of these movies, the thing I'm most excited about is not necessarily, like, you know, I'm sure Matt Reeves is going to probably do a good Batman movie. He directed these two movies really well. But I'm most excited coming out and be like, I want to see what, like, Weta's going to do next.
Yep.
You know, I want to see, like, that side of things. I want to see, like, who's the new Caesar, you know? Who's going to be that character? Where does this technology go going forward? Because to me, that's, like, the real star of the movie is that and, like, capturing that performance in that way.
Or, like, what's Andy Serkis going to do next?
Exactly, yes.
And he's going to go into directing, and he's got Warner Brothers' Jungle Book movie coming out. And if it were anyone else, I'd say, we already have that from Disney, we don't need it. I want to see what Andy Serkis does with that.
Yeah.
Especially because it's not a Disney version of it. You know?
Yeah, so it is that, like, I'm watching these movies just makes me so excited to see where the technology goes. It's unbelievably impressive. It's just an amazing accomplishment, particularly seeing it grow throughout each of the movies, because it does take a little bit watching the first one, which is titled Rise of the Planet of the
Apes,
not Dawn, which is like those... That was a huge mistake on their part, is those two titles, because they're so fucking similar. But yeah, the first couple of, like, you know, the first couple of scenes of Rise of the Planet of the Apes with some of the CG chimpanzees, it takes you a second to buy in, because it's an older movie now, but I think, but even if the, like, specific quality of, like, the models maybe looks dated in that movie, the quality of, like, the performance capture itself means you buy into that performance pretty quickly, especially, like, once Caesar enters the movie and starts kind of, like, becoming a more of a character. But then after that, like once you get to Dawn and War of the Planet of the Apes, like, it's utterly seamless.
Oh, particularly in War, where half that movie is close-ups on CGI apes.
Yeah, like, in the snow and everything. It's like, because it's also, like, they're... I mean, that's the thing that's the most amazing thing about it is that they are in these, like, incredibly dynamic environments all the time. Because it's, like, they're shot on location, so it's, like, they're in forests, they're, like, in the snow, and you have the actors there, like, interacting with these environments that are full of motion and little objects that, like, react realistically to these actors in there, because the actors are actually there. But that does so much to selling it, because that's the stuff that on, like, another, like, other CGI characters would be the first thing you see that's like, oh, like, this character clearly was on a soundstage, because they're, like, not actually, they're, like, very specifically not interacting with anything in the environment other than the actor. And, like, everything else is, like, you're, like, yeah, this little, like, force field around the character, because nothing can actually touch them. And you never have that in these movies. And so it just sells this incredible ability to just buy these characters and buy into this world where these chimpanzees are super smart. And not just the chimpanzees, because also Maurice is awesome.
That's
probably my favorite part of War for the Planet of the Apes, is that they gave Maurice a whole lot of stuff to do, because that character was kind of in the background in the first two movies. But yeah, like just the ability to buy into those characters and really sort of, like, fall in love with them, and particularly with, obviously, Caesar, because he's the main character, like, really getting invested into his character arc and where he goes and who he is. It's an unbelievable element of those movies.
Well, it's like, why it works so well is this is 100% special effects in service of a story.
Exactly.
And not just a good story.
Yeah.
A really well-told story, a story that you could not tell without this tech. And it's something Andy Serkis, I've watched a lot of interviews with him lately, because, boy, he's fascinating to listen to. He's a genius. And the way he talks about this, he always says, like, you know, with what other technology could I play a character from birth to where I wind up in War for the Planet of the Apes? And spoilers from here on out.
Sure, yeah.
Because I don't want to dance around it too long.
Right.
Because Andy Serkis keeps having to dance around it. But he dies at the end of that movie.
Yes.
And as thematically, he had to
for
that film. But, like, yeah, he got to play a character from birth to death and show all these steps in the middle. And that's the magic of these movies, is that it's just acting underneath. You know, it's just an actor doing their job. But it's like they have this very expensive, fancy makeup that allows them to do things as an actor they'd never be able to do otherwise. And I also love that as these movies go on, you know, Maurice and Caesar are in all three. Yeah. But they start drawing in other
actors.
And
Rocket's in all three. He's really good.
Yeah, so you have Andy Serkis, Karen Cannavale, who plays Maurice, and God, I forget the name of the guy who plays Rocket, but he's also their ape coordinator or something on set, mm-hmm. where he like teaches them how to do all the ape stuff. He also played King Kong in Kong Skull Island. But anyway, so those three guys have been there throughout. But then they started bringing in other actors. So, you know, you have like Judy Greer is Caesar's wife.
Right.
And you have Toby Kebbell plays the evil ape in the second movie.
Koba.
And he's so good in that movie. And then in the third movie, you have the character played by, you have Bad Ape played by Steve Zahn. Mm-hmm. And he's so good. And so like, they got to bring in all these other actors who they'd never done mocap before, but it's just acting at this point,
yeah.
and the technology fits them, and you have, you know, these people like Andy Serkis who are these great role models of it, and it's really cool to see them take to this technology. And it's like, you look at that and you're like, you know, digital is not as scary a future as it is when you watch Transformers.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, there's something to this.
Yeah. But, like, the other thing is that, because it is obviously, like, the heart of the performance is in, like, what Andy Serkis does with Caesar, but it's also, you know, humans are not chimpanzees,
right?
Obviously. And so there's like all the work in like that has to go into translating the facial performance of a human being onto a chimpanzee. That's like, we don't have all the same muscles. Our faces are not structured. Like, our bone structure is different. And so like what the artists and the animators do in translating that stuff is just beautiful. Like, it's amazing.
Weta Digital is so completely heads and tails beyond everyone else in this industry right now. Like, they are, I think, in so many ways, the most important, like, movie house in the world of the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Because of where they've pushed things. They did Gollum. They did Peter Jackson's King Kong. They basically invented and pioneered this whole new way to do these things. And it just, at the, if Weta's name is on a movie, it will be pioneering in some way or another.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that they've kept that up. The Adventures of Tintin, another great one. That's all animated, but equally impressive. And Weta did all that. It's the only full animated movie they've done. But, like, yeah, it's... I agree with you what you said. Like, they are special effects movies, but you can think of them like Weta is like Harryhausen or something.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a put-down to call these special effects movies.
No, yeah.
Again, if you were to compare them to Transformers or something.
Yeah, because it's something where, like... Because the thing with Transformers is there are a lot of special effects... But they're fucking terrible special effects. In the same way that, like, you know, Ray Harryhausen was not the only person that did stop motion stuff in the 50s and 60s. He was just the best one. And, like, there are plenty of, like, terrible fucking stop motion effects that were done. But his movies are amazing, both because, like, they tell very good, like, character-driven stories and they're fun to action sort of adventure stories. But also, like, there's a huge amount of talent and artistry that goes into synthesizing the special effects with the stories and really making that work. And that is like, these movies just feel like a successor to that to me.
And that's the magic, is when you can blend a good story with that pioneering work, you know? So let's talk about the stories.
Okay.
You know, I mentioned here, I'm definitely of the opinion the movies get better as they go along. To me, I think Rise is a fascinating, it's a very good film. I think it's got problems in terms of some of how it casts the human characters.
Sure, yeah.
And then I like the next two movies because they become so much slower and more atmospheric. And, I mean, there's some of those, parts of those last two movies are art house films in how mm-hmm. they're pitched, you know. But what were your thoughts on them?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rise is obviously the black sheep of the series. Like, it's still, like, it's a good movie. It's a really enjoyable movie,
yes.
is the way I think about it. It's got, I mean, some really great sequences. I think, like, all the stuff with Caesar once he's put into, like, the sort of, like, pin or whatever with all the other chimpanzees and him having to sort of like figure out what to do and how to take control. That's a really like fantastic stretch of that movie.
And there's some like action sequences in that movie. Yeah. The Golden Gate Bridge scene is out of this world.
Yeah. So it's like when that movie, I think it's like one of the things where you see like when that movie is able to sort of like fully just do the chimpanzee stuff, they fucking knock it out of the park and like that stuff's the best stuff. And like James Franco's fine instead of like, you know, a lot of the human characters are fine, but they don't necessarily like stand out as being particularly like strong or exceptional characters. There's also like there's some weird stuff in that movie where it feels like it's like very sort of like wink and nod at the audience in places of like, oh, here's a like a shuttle launched to Mars, wink wink, like damn dirty apes.
It is very interesting to see how the first movie is very overt in its references. The references don't go away in films 2 and 3. They just become part of the text in a way that they don't wink at you. Like, the third movie, a lot of it is devoted to a plot point from the original films that humans can't talk.
Yeah.
But it's not just a wink-wink. It's, let's make a story out of that.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, the first one just has some of those weird little elements, but it's a very fun movie. But I think it is the second and third ones. And I probably like the second a little bit more than the third. They're both about even for me. I think for me, I just like Caesar's character arc in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I think, a little bit more. I think, like, his stuff there is so interesting and so kind of meaty, and, like, seeing that character in that form. Whereas, like, for War for the Planet of the Apes, like, Caesar's character arc and everything in that movie is fine. It just maybe, like, leans a little bit too much into the cliche, maybe, for, like, that role. And it's more of a continuation of what you saw, whereas I think, like, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, you see Andy Serkis, like, fully get into that role, like, fully sort of, like, become Caesar. And just his ability to be that, like, very Shakespearean kind of, like Henry the Fourth or Henry the Fifth kind of character. Or I guess kind of like Julius Caesar. Yeah. Like that is so cool in that movie. And just the stuff of, like, I think about the scenes sort of at the beginning of the third act or whatever, that movie, after Caesar's been hurt and he's being taken care of by the humans in his old house. All that stuff is so just beautifully done.
I agree. I think Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War are very close in quality to me. I prefer War, if only I think it's a little more consistent for me. Dawn, I love until the action climax, which I think is a mess. I think it feels like something they reshot after there was something else that was thrown out, which I think was the case. But, like, the whole thing where they're on the tower, it's too, like, CGI to me, which I know is a weird complaint for these movies, but so much of Dawn and War are on location, on in real physical places, and then the end is sort of like, it's too clean an ending for the themes of that movie, which is Koba is the antagonist, but he's not, like, the mustache twirling villain, you know?
Sure.
And he's a fascinating character, and when it becomes just, we gotta go kill him, like, it's a little too clean to me at the end of that movie. Although then I think the actual ending is very bold and interesting of, like, we can't stop this war, let's all hold hands and wait for the end, which is basically how that movie ends, and I love that. Whereas War, I agree that it's a very traditional character arc. I just thought it was done phenomenally, and I think a lot of just the filmmaking along the way is fascinating. I also think War, I like that War is completely ape POV all the way through.
Sure, yeah.
Because Dawn, I actually like what they do with the human characters in Dawn, because none of them, like, that's the problem with Rise, is it has those two characters played by Brian Cox and Draco Malfoy, whatever his name is, Tom Felton, who are just mustache-twirling bad guys. Yeah. And in Dawn, no one's like that. They're all people. And the apes are all ape. Like, there's no one whose perspective you don't understand. And so it's okay, but it's still, like, the humans aren't the most interesting part. And I like that War is all apes all the time. But when you do get the humans, it's fucking Woody Harrelson, and he's amazing.
Sure, yeah.
But yeah. But I see what you're saying. I mean, Dawn, I think at its best, Dawn is some of the best stuff in that series. Like, the first half hour of that movie has no dialogue.
Yeah.
It's just sign language. What other movie are you going to go see in a Cineplex that has that much sign language in it? I love it.
Yeah.
And I also think there's that action sequence where Koba attacks the humans. One of the best action sequences I've ever seen. Because of two things. One, the way that movie builds, you don't want there to be action.
Yeah.
Like, viscerally, you don't want there to be. So when it comes, it's upsetting. And then the cinematography and everything there is so out of this world. There's that long shot where Koba gets in the tank, and he takes that over so he can fire. And they all do it from right behind the pilot seat of the tank. And they go through all of that. I don't know how they did that. That's one of those shots I look at, and I'm like, I don't know how you physically pulled that off.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, no. So, yeah, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, it just has... I think that having the human side of it in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes be a little bit more prominent, whereas for War for the Planet of the Apes, it's basically completely gone. Like, I think that actually is something I like. Like, I kind of wish maybe War for the Planet of the Apes had a little bit more of that, because I think having that contrast and playing with that a little bit heavier is part of, like, what... It's part of what Planet of the Apes is about to me, and I think, like, Dawn captures that, whereas, like, War for the Planet of the Apes... The Woody Harrelson character is a lot of fun and he's cool, but, like, he also, like, reads very cliche to me. Like even in the ways they try to complicate him, feel like cliche's ways to complicate that character in some ways.
I guess. I just, you know, to me it's also about, you know, where are we following the arc of the story? Because, you know, Dawn has less human stuff than Rise.
Yeah.
And to me it's like, it's because this is ultimately Caesar and the Apes' story. And at this point, the humans are irrelevant. They're dying. Like, that's one of the interesting, like, War for the Planet of the Apes does have a lot of cliched elements, but it also has a lot of parts that I found surprising and unexpected. Like, it's called War, and there's almost no action in it.
Right.
You know, it's a very quiet movie, and that you think it's going to be about Caesar getting the gang together and fighting the humans. Not in the slightest. It's the humans are tearing themselves apart, and they are going to die with or without the apes, and they are vestigial at this point. Right. And I think that's an interesting idea. So there's things like that I just found. But I mean, it's we're comparing two great things,
exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
And they are consistently such surprising movies because even when they go into territory where we kind of know some of the beats, they do it in ways that we've never seen before.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because that is the benefit of having like this special effect technology and being able to have these ape characters that, like, by the very nature of what they are, you have not seen a character like that. Like, even when, like, in some ways, like, you know, Caesar calls back to a lot of, like, classic sort of character archetypes, you've never seen a character, those character archetypes, done in this way because he's a fucking chimpanzee.
Yes.
You know, so it's like, that's kind of a big deal. And so, yeah, even, like I think that in some ways, it almost feels like in some ways on the ape side of things, them going for some cliches works because it highlights the twist that this, like, this sort of very different perspective and this very different kind of culture they come from that is made for these movies changes what those cliches kind of mean.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's also, there's just so many scenes throughout, you know, those movies that just are burned in my mind. Like, and the big one from War for the Planet of the Apes to me is the long sequence where Maurice and Rocket and Caesar are moving through trying to, they're on their, this isn't a pun, it's what they're doing. They're on a guerrilla warfare mission.
Right. Sure.
Anyway. But they're going and they wind up in that little abandoned settlement. And that's where they find the little girl.
Right.
And the long scene where Maurice is befriending the little girl is, I think, one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen out of Hollywood. Because it is silent, it is all just expressions, and it is expressions of a woman playing an orangutan, done in CGI, but looking completely photorealistic, and it's all this extreme close-up on the face. And the most amazing thing about Maurice is an orangutan does not have a human facial structure. You know, it's very different, and that just shows how good Weta and Karen Konoval were at bringing that character to life. And there's this story that is told between these two figures who are very different, but come together in that moment. That's one of those ones that just blows me away. I love the character of Bad Ape in that movie, who is, on one level, plucky comic relief, but also really sad and helps bring Caesar's story into relief. Yeah. And
The one thing that I really like about having Bad Ape there is that it shows that not all the ape characters are like these very serious, dour, like some of them have to, come on, like some of them have to have some fun.
Yes. And you understand why Caesar's settlement is so dour.
Yeah.
There's another, Matt Reeves clearly is a very talented action director, because that opening scene in War for the Planet of the Apes was that long pan through the jungle and everything that breaks out there. That's another super impressive scene.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, if I were to take out all the other DC baggage, the idea of him directing a Batman movie, let alone any superhero movie, is very exciting to me.
Yeah, definitely.
Because he's clearly very talented. And I think he, you know, these are dark, gritty movies, but with the requisite heart and humanity to them.
Yeah, because it is, they are so about their characters, and it is about like the core cast of characters, and like Caesar's character arc, and how he evolves and changes, and that he, you know, he wants to do good, and he's trying to do his best for these apes that follow him. Yeah, they're always centered in that, so it does have, there's a hopeful element to them even when they're at their darkest.
Yeah. I really do think, you know, there are little issues here and there throughout the films, but I think it's one of the great achievements Hollywood has had this decade.
Yeah, I agree. I think they're going to be like three of the most defining movies in terms of like special effects and some like action stuff, like,
and they've
of this decade.
And they've been successful at the box office, but I do think their legacy is going to be, there's going to be a generation of young people who saw these movies and are going to become directors because of it.
Right.
And as much as I love like the Marvel movies and stuff, I don't think they're going to have that kind of effect of like creative inspiration. These are movies I can imagine, like Star Wars, like Lord of the Rings, people are going to cite in 20 years of like, I saw something I didn't think could be done and I made movies because of it.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to have a big influence on that, because I think they've really blown open the basket for me on what is a Hollywood studio blockbuster, what can they look like, what kind of themes can they tackle, what kind of artistry can they have on display. Because again, one of the things I love about those last two Matt Reeves movies is that they are slow and they are atmospheric, and they take you places that I don't think a lot of studio blockbusters ever would.
Yeah, they also like managed to be, this is like something I love about them, we are in this like age of like dystopian post-apocalyptic fiction, and this like round of Planet of the Apes movies are technically that, but they are so different.
Yep.
Like, they have such a different sort of perspective. There's such a different way of telling their stories. And I think, and it's that, like, it is only dystopian and post-apocalyptic to us because we're humans, and so we, at some instinctive level, have to adopt a certain human point of view and being like, well, all the humans are dead, and that's kind of fucked up. But for all the apes, it is... I mean, it's not the opposite of dystopian, because it's certainly not utopian for them, but it is about them building civilization, not civilization crumbling down around them.
And, you know, even if Rise of the Planet of the Apes is obviously the weakest in some ways, it's still a, you know, crucial, very good film, and I love that there is this really clear three-film arc where it is the creation story. The creation myth for the apes. Like, you know, the original Planet of the Apes takes place like thousands of years later, but they talk about Caesar, and you can tell, like, it's like a Moses story or something, like, which they very clearly reference in...
Yes, in war. Yeah.
But, like, I do love that you follow him from birth to death, and along the way you see all these little things that build in terms of what is his mythology going to be? What is he going to mean to this civilization going forward? And just, there are so many levels of callbacks throughout the films. You know, just that, you know, he has that little line in the first movie, apes together strong, and he does the little thing about the sticks, and that becomes like this calling symbol that everyone does by the third movie, and I love it. And just... You know, I was surprised genuinely by the amount of emotional heft the end of war carries, where, you know, you have Caesar's death and Maurice is there and Maurice talks, which Maurice doesn't usually like to do.
Yeah.
But it's this kind of crucial scene, and that, you know, your son will know your story in this thing, and seeing, and it, you know, it's an ending where they look out on a happy sunset, but it's a very earned happy sunset.
Yeah.
They've been through hell, and it's, you know, it's this, it's a very beautiful ending to have followed this character this far and get a sense of, like, yes, this, we saw this myth being told, and, like, you know, I wish we made biblical movies with the skill Matt Reeves made this, you know?
Exactly,
like,
yeah.
Like, because there's a reason we make Moses movies and stuff, but people don't make them like this anymore.
No, yeah.
And this is a better Moses movie, probably, than that Ridley Scott one.
Yes.
With Christian Bale as Moses. Yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah, these movies are great. Like, I'm curious to see if at some point they're just going to, if they would want to keep on going forward with this, if they would just do a remake of Planet of the Apes at some point, which I would be up for that with this technology.
Yeah, or like, not even call it a remake, but like a riff on that idea.
Yeah, you know? but that kind of similar plot or whatever,
right.
And like have, you know, follow Cornelius because he's grown up.
So Thomas and I were thinking, like, because they haven't closed the door on doing a fourth one, you know?
Uh-huh.
Although, very clearly, Matt Reeves was allowed to make this as a finale, because it's a pretty definitive ending.
Yeah.
But, like, we were saying, like, what if they wanted to make a fourth one with Caesar? And my brother joked, it would start up with, like, Caesar collapses at the end of that, and then someone runs over and's like, look, we met a doctor! It's Dr. Zaius! From the original.
Yeah.
It's like, he can heal you, Caesar! And, like, they save him, and he's like, all right. It's like, and there's some evil humans over that ridge! And it's like, oh, we gotta fight the evil humans!
Yeah.
And I was just trying to imagine, like, what's the worst way they could extend that?
Yeah, just, like, the most cliche, ridiculous action blockbuster.
It is. I will say, though, like, this trilogy so clearly follows the qualitative arc of the Bourne trilogy for me, in that I also worry, like, it'll have that effect of, in a couple of years, they're going to try to make, like...
Julius Caesar.
Well, no, they're going to make the Caesar Legacy.
Okay.
Where they won't have any of those characters.
Right. Yeah, that other Bourne movie.
Yes.
Right.
No one remembers
then
it.
Then after that, they make Julius Caesar.
Yes. Yeah. But, yeah, I do worry that at some point they're going to do the soulless cash-in follow-up. But, hey, we have the great trilogy, and I'm happy with that. And I'm almost happy War for the Planet of the Apes hasn't, like, lit the box office on fire just because it will stop them from doing a sequel right away. Although I do wish it was making a little more money because it's just so good, and I want people to see it. That's all. I'm not getting any of that money. But, yeah.
Yeah, but I agree with you that I think that 10, 20, 30 years from now, like, there will be directors, like, making movies that's like, I saw these movies when I was growing up, and they showed me that you can, like what movies can, in the same way that, you know, like, Peter Jackson talks about one of the reasons why he remade King Kong was because, obviously, King Kong did not come out when he was a kid, but he watched King Kong when he was growing up, and that was, like, a movie to him that was, like, you can do impossible things. Like, you can make a story about a giant ape which fights a giant Tyrannosaurus Rex and, like, falls in love with this human woman, and you can make a movie about that, and that's, like, an inspiring thing.
Yeah, I mean, the lesson of these movies to me is the sky is the limit. You
exactly.
can do anything if they pulled this off.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so that's our movie talk. You want to do some game talk?
Let's talk about some video games.
All right, let's go down the list. Destiny 2's beta.
Destiny 2?
So you talked about it last week.
Yeah.
You covered the bases pretty well, but I just want to follow up a little bit on this. So.
Yeah, because you've managed to play now.
Yep. So the beta had one campaign mission, one strike, and two crucible modes. And I did do the campaign mission with all three character types.
Yeah.
And so I got a little taste of all of those. I also played it on both the PS4 and Xbox One.
Huh?
Because I downloaded it first on the PS4 because I didn't have my Xbox plugged in. And once I beat the campaign mission, I went to play The Strike, and I didn't know you had to have PlayStation Plus for the beta. And my PlayStation Plus has lapsed. So I was like, well, can't play that. So it had taken me 12 hours to download that fucking thing, because PSN download speeds are
right,
pathetic.
Yeah.
So I turned off my PlayStation, plugged in my Xbox, and downloaded it there. It only took like 40 minutes on Xbox, but then I had to replay it on Xbox. So they look mostly the same, if you want to have a quick comparison. I did think the PS4 looked a little better, but it's not a scientific comparison.
Right.
But yeah, so I played with all three. My reaction was, I went into the Destiny 2 beta interested, but not necessarily over the moon excited for Destiny 2, because we've played a lot of Destiny these last 3 years.
Yeah.
This is now one of my most anticipated games of the year, and if Mario wasn't coming out in October, it would be easily the thing I'm most excited for. The stuff they gave in this beta, there's not a lot of it, but oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think that campaign mission, I played it 3 times, is probably the best campaign mission in Destiny so far. Like, it feels like they learned from everything in the expansions of Destiny 1 and made a mission that is just so good, allows itself to kind of unshackle itself from the chains of go here, activate ghosts, fight 3 waves, and then see what happens, you know. I loved moving through the tower out as it's falling. That's just a great way to start a game.
I think it's got that fantastic part where you're like, you go out into the main area of the tower that you know you spend all your time in Destiny 1, and Zavala is there, like, fighting against all these ships coming in and stuff, and that's when they seamlessly drop you in with a bunch of other Destiny people who are playing, and so it's like that kind of promise that Destiny always had of, like, the seamless co-op stuff, and, like, you don't even necessarily need to know who these people are, but all of a sudden you're playing with them. But Destiny only ever did that when either you loaded into, like, a Strike or a Crucible or something, obviously, where you're in, like, a matchmaking thing, or when you're out on your patrols, and then you randomly ran into people. But it never happened in the middle of, like, a big mission thing, because in the middle of a big mission thing, you went into a, like, sectioned-off area where, like, everyone else despawned. It was just you and the people you were playing with, you were in a fire squad. And so I thought, that was awesome. It's just such an awesome moment in the middle of that mission that you come out and it's like, oh, now I'm fighting with people, even though I was playing this mission solo, because it creates this sense of, like, we are all, you know, like, all these Guardians are on the tower, and so it's like, it's a much bigger fight than just me. It's me and these story characters that were only ever featured, you know, either in a handful of cutscenes or standing around one table on the tower in the entirety of Destiny 1, and now Zavala, I'm fighting with Zavala, and then there's all these other people with me, too.
Yep, like, all of the three main, like, you know, Zavala and Cade and... Yeah. Other, what's her name? Warlock Lady.
Yeah.
She's really cool. But anyway,
I never remember
all
name.
Three of them have great moments in that mission. And I just, in general, love the way they mix the story in there, where it doesn't ever slow down the gameplay, but you have, I mean, there's a cutscene in the middle, but other than that, it doesn't slow things down. And it just really, like, it helps propel you through. The writing is very good. I also liked, you know, Taken King and Rise of Iron had much better writing than the main game, but they also were mostly a joke machine and they didn't really take anything seriously. Sure. This was, we had our jokes and they were funny, but there was also a genuine sense of, like, scale and a threat and that the characters were taking this seriously. And then I thought the last cutscene in particular where you meet the villain.
Yeah.
Hoo boy, that was great. That's a phenomenal scene, and it's like, right, this is the studio that made Halo, and that's one of the only times I've felt that narratively out of Destiny.
Yeah, I agree. That it does. They set up their villain really well. I love just, like, the image of when you're fighting through, and there's just this huge fucking metal cloth thing or whatever clamped onto the Traveler, and you definitely get this sense of, like, shit is fucked up at the beginning of this game. You are not this, like, nice, cozy guardian in your beautiful tower overlooking the last city on Earth, just like la-di-da-di-da. Like, you're not just going out and fighting in the Cosmodrome or on Venus or whatever. Like, the fight has come to where you are, and I love that. Like, one thing I love about it is when you're fighting through the tower, there are just, like, random civilians and stuff that are, like, cowering, and you have the, what's his name, like, Lord Shax or whatever, like, opens up that door for you near the beginning of the mission, and he's, like, protecting all these other people that are just there, that are just more normal people. And that's something you just never saw in Destiny, was, like, the actual humans that are living there. Like, it was only ever the Guardians running around on the tower. And just, it's, like, a lot of really small touches that give this sense of narrative, a sense of, like, context and place and, like, humanity that, like, old Destiny, as good as, like, the combat and all that stuff was just could never convey any of that, no matter how hard it wanted to try.
I should also say, I was not prepared for just what a big step up the graphics took in this.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's the same art style, generally. So, you know, it might not strike you at first, like, first blush, but, like, once you get into that mission, they are doing things with visual scale in this that are off the charts.
Yeah.
When you look out at some of those skyboxes, and as you say, like, the metal thing on the tower, or just that entire sequence where you're on the ship, and it's raining, and it's windy.
Yeah.
It's some of the most impressive graphics I've seen on the new generation consoles, and definitely is like, thank God they abandoned the old consoles for this, because this looks so good.
Yeah, it is definitely, it is exciting whenever Bungie puts out another game, if for no other reason than you get like the next level of Bungie skyboxes.
Yes.
It's like, holy shit, Bungie's really good at making skyboxes.
Bungie has changed a lot. That's something that has not changed.
Yeah, they only ever get better.
They only, no, that's absolutely true. I also thought the sound design got better.
Yeah, I really like the weapon sounds and yes. like the like jump sound effects. I thought like the way they sort of punch those up sound really good.
The sound design in Destiny 1 is very good, but like I think it lags behind something like a Halo 4.
Mm-hmm.
This was on par with that, I thought. Of like yeah. everything felt, as you say, very punchy, very there's a lot of depth to it. I noticed the sound design more than I ever did in Destiny 1. And yeah, just I was really into it. And you know, the gameplay, I don't know if there's a lot to talk about other than you kind of detailed all the system changes and stuff. I really did like how they streamlined the stuff with the subclasses.
Yeah,
I found myself like engaged in the subclass systems more than I kind of ever was in 3 years of Destiny, just because they were so hard to figure out and opaque in a lot of ways.
Right.
But this, I particularly love what they added to the circle or B button, your like yeah. extra move. And all of them are very useful and cool. I particularly love Titan, your mobile cover you can put down.
Yeah.
That's great. But I also, I at one point, God, I love with the Hunter what they did with that plus the melee chains.
Yes.
There's a part in the Strike where there's all those little like beasts that come after you, the new enemy type.
Uh-huh.
And I got a thing going where I would dodge roll, punch one, kill it in one hit, and that would reload my melee, and it would reload my dodge. And I just dodged around and killed like 20 of those in a melee chain, and it was the most amazing thing ever. I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah, the Arc Strider was definitely like my favorite class I played, because I lean towards Hunter anyways, but that like that's the thing I like in like I like to play that kind of class in games, of being like this sort of more mobile up close kind of character, and the Hunter in Destiny 1 had some of those kinds of things, but never really captured that side of it. Mm-hmm. It always the Hunter felt like a bit more tuned for being a more long range character, even when you were the sword class or whatever. And this, the Arc Strider, I think really captures that feeling of like you are up in their face. I've got my fucking hand cannon or whatever. I'm blowing them away. Like roll towards them, punch them, roll away, punch another guy. It really gets that down
yeah.
pat.
I probably still lean Titan, and that's what I'm probably going to play when the game comes out. But I really loved Hunter and want to play that
yeah.
too. Like both of those like are great. I thought the Warlock is still a little too floaty, but whatever.
But at least now they're like they have the one subclass that leans into floatiness, because he literally can fucking fly when you need him to. So.
Yes. So it's very cool. The class system has only gotten better.
Yeah.
The shooting is as tight and good as it ever has been, but I thought, you know, the enemy layouts and everything were even better. Little changes like that. I loved all the weapon design.
Yeah.
And I love that you got like that random assortment of weapons so you could try them out and see like the submachine gun and some of the other things they've added.
Yeah.
All very cool. I loved every weapon I used. So
yeah.
it was a ton of fun in that way. The campaign mission was great. The strike even better. Just that strike is phenomenal. And unlike a lot of the later era Destiny strikes that I think got kind of short and I was feeling like these are too brief and that's
right.
not what a strike should be, this one felt like it was not super long, but long enough to feel like it had meat on its bones
yeah.
and multiple points of real challenge. Like my brother and I were playing it on Xbox Live, and halfway through a person dropped out and I was like, legitimately, I don't know if we can do this with two people. And we managed to, but it took a couple tries at the end and it was a really fun challenge.
Yeah, there's a really fantastic sense of progression over the course of that strike. Of like, mm-hmm. there's a lot of different phases, and you're always kind of doing something different, and you're very mobile, and like, there's just a lot going on. Like, you know, some of my favorite parts are when you come out to like that big battlefield that just like stretches out in front of you that looks like, you know, if Bungie was still making Halo games, it looks like what a like Bungie Halo level would be today, instead of like the very narrow Halo levels we unfortunately get in the Halo 5 games and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But you come out on that battlefield, and it's just like, because when I was playing it was just like two random people, it was this fun sense of like you're kind of like up tight and claustrophobic in this sort of tighter area, and then you come out in this battlefield and like not obviously not really talking to each other because we weren't on voice chat, like me and these two other random people just like kind of naturally spread out and like just like took over the whole scope of the battlefield, and like I went down the middle, one guy went to the left, one guy went to the right, and like we kind of fanned out, took all the enemies and came back and funneled back in, coming back into the other side of the battlefield, and like that felt really good and natural. And then when you move in past that spot and then you get to the big spinning excavator thing, that whole just like running, like again, is I just love the sense of mobility in Destiny and the just all this action going on and you like jumping around and then like getting the drop on enemies. It's really fucking cool.
I like how Destiny has decided platforming is a part of the game now.
Yeah, you've always had all these jumping abilities and you don't really have much cause to use them a lot of the time. So like baking that into the strike, I thought worked really well.
Absolutely. No, the strike is great, and I thought for both of the PvE events, the challenge was good.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing I felt was missing from the Taken King and Rise of Iron, in part because they took out your ability to modify the challenge level. They were too easy. And vanilla Destiny, you can make a lot of criticisms. I loved the difficulty of it.
Yeah.
And that kind of went away, and it feels like, fingers crossed, that's back in Destiny 2, because these were a solid challenge. Obviously not the hardest things in that game, probably, but like I felt like I was tested, and I liked that. Because, I mean, that's always the thing with Bungie. Halo, you have to play on Heroic or higher.
Yeah.
Like, that's when it's good.
Uh-huh.
It was fine on Normal, but you got to be challenged, because Bungie's very good at that.
Yeah, because just, like, having that challenge is what forces you to, like, make the full use of your abilities.
Mm-hmm. I liked Crucible a lot when I played of it. I probably played 7 or 8 matches. I did not like the new mode that they had in the other playlist, but I now barely remember what it was.
Yeah, I only played that once. I played a couple of rounds of the like territories mode or whatever, like Control, I think it's called.
Control. It was good. I liked the new. I thought the maps were better. I'll say that. Like they felt like, okay, they have a clearer sense of what they want the maps to be. And it's only one map per mode, but I just did feel that like playing it. Like this is a really tight Control map. It has some of the problems I think Crucible has always had, and this is something that was thrown into relief for me by Splatoon 2, which we'll talk about in a moment, which is a surprisingly competitive game. Destiny has always had the issue where I feel like, other than a couple of matches you'll get that are really competitive, it's often within a minute you know who's going to win, and you kind of just have to run down the clock, and especially on Control, which I think is a weirdly balanced game mode, it's very hard to come from behind at any level. But I still liked it a lot. I generally like that kind of thing, and I want to play more Crucible when the full game comes out. So
yeah, like for me, the big thing with Crucible, because I didn't do a huge amount of it in Destiny 1, but I liked in Destiny 2, there was just a better sense of balance, because that was what at some point really pushed me away from Crucible in Destiny 1, was it just was like, fuck, like if I want to actually be able to play well, like I have to have like the thorn and like this, like then use these abilities and all this shit. And like have to play this very specific way, or you will get absolutely steamrolled because the game is not balanced at all. And so like most of the builds and like weapon types and stuff were not actually useful in Destiny 1 if you wanted to be effective in the PvP.
Yeah.
And Destiny 2, obviously part of it is that there's a bunch of new stuff and people have not like sort of cracked how to like, you know, maximize everything in the game. But I think they're also just the changes they've made to the weapon setup and the changes they've made to like the way the subclasses work means that inherently there is less sort of room for these like really specific build types that then just like break the balance of the game. They have sort of like designed with that in mind. And so I like that.
I think the 4v4 change is also smart.
Yeah.
It used to be 6v6, which
is so chaotic. When you have like supers and all the like the insane shit that can go on in Destiny going on in the 6v6 match. Yeah. It was just impossible to get your head around like how the match was going and what was going on where.
The other issue I will say, I did experience, like, the strike in Crucible, Bungie has to implement some kind of penalty system for people dropping out. It's a huge problem in Destiny 1, and it looks like they've done nothing to address that here, and it angers me a little bit just because it's like, it's clearly like there's no penalty whatsoever for people dropping out or just not playing, and people farm that in this game,
right,
and break that system, and like we had... It turned out, actually, when I said someone dropped out of our strike in that we played, they didn't drop out. They just stopped playing and then came back at the end and got the loot.
Right.
You know, and people do that all the time in this game.
Which doesn't make sense for the beta. Why? I mean, I think it's an asshole thing to do anyways. But also, it's the fucking beta, dude. This is going to be gone in a week.
Right. It's so extra weird there. But it is like, Destiny is, at its best, this social game. And it is cool to drop in with people and play. But you've got to have something to keep people there because people break that system too much, and it is something I hope they can... It shouldn't be that hard. Like, if you drop out, you don't get to play for 10 minutes or something like that. Like, they did that in Halo back in the day.
Right, yeah.
And it worked pretty well. So, you know, there's ways to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I am very, very excited to go headfirst into this game in September.
Yeah, I think, like, the biggest testament to the quality of the Destiny 2 beta is that we're both really excited to play it, and there was no real loot drops, and there was no experience or leveling up. Like, the whole grind was basically removed from the experience of the Destiny 2 beta, and it was still a huge amount of fun to play.
Yeah, and I just got this sense of, like, oh, this is all the improvement we got in Destiny over the years, but it's all new.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what I wanted. It's unshackled from that, and I am so excited to just have a fresh start with Destiny, and hopefully a much larger percentage of it is great. And a lot of Destiny 1 was great, but if more of this one's great, if it is a new game with the improvements we had along the way, plus more improvements, I think we're in for something very special.
Yeah.
In a year that's been pretty special for video games.
Exactly.
Yeah. Speaking of video games.
Speaking about a year that is special in video games, I don't know how I have managed to be calm and collected over the course of this podcast, because, as I said at the top of this podcast, I finished Nier Automata. I finished it last night, almost at 11 o'clock p.m. on the dot, because I made a tweet basically immediately after I finished the game, and then I started another playthrough just to be like 100% sure they're not going to throw any other insanity at me. And it was like, okay, I'm actually done with the game. And I've played like 3 hours into another playthrough this morning because it's very good. But so like I sort of started that new game for a little bit just to be sure they're not going to like fucking blow my mind again, I went and I made a tweet that just said people really should play Nier Automata. And there's a part of me that feels like maybe that's all I should say, because play this fucking video game, like seriously, play it, because it has probably the best ending to a game I've ever seen. It has definitely the most incredible last boss fight fucking ever. But it is just, it is a mind-blowing experience. It is what they do at the end of this game, and like everything about the ending, like it's not just necessarily one thing, but it's just this whole accumulation of stuff. It is such a powerful narrative and thematic experience, and the way that that game sort of crystallizes its themes in its like final moment is so unbelievably powerful. It's just like, I finished the game and I was just sitting there being like, what the holy fucking shit? This game is fucking amazing. I made a huge mistake playing at 11 because I got no sleep because I was sitting there in my bed just thinking about this game and just like replaying it in my mind and replaying like what the fuck they do. And
that was me with Taipei Story last night, but in a very different way.
Yeah, like trust me, it was would have been a very different way. Because it's something that obviously I can't tell you any of like what they do past a certain point. Because it's like a big, I don't think like if you found out what it was, it doesn't mean that it wouldn't have an impact on you. But a huge part of the joy of it is like getting to this point and realizing sort of what's happening and where it's going, and having this Yoko Taro, the narrative like and game director of the game, just sort of take you by the hand and be like, this is where we're going. You're like, oh, this is where we're going. That's like, that part is so much of the joy of it, because it is just, I think the best sort of non-spoilery way I can kind of describe it is the Nier Automata feels like, in a lot of ways, in a very broad sense, like if Hideo Kojima was able to like get his shit together and tell a story that was focused on one theme and one idea, instead of making a story in a game that is like spread across like 500 different thematic ideas that none of them really build up each other. And, you know, we talked about on our Metal Gear Solid podcast that some of his games, like Metal Gear Solid 3 and Peace Walker, fare better in that space. But most of his games utterly fall apart because they can't fucking focus on anything.
At best, Hideo Kojima's games are beautiful messes.
Exactly. And Nier Automata, like, has so much of the creativity and the vision and the brilliance and the insight that Kojima displays in a lot of his games in terms of, like, how to use the video game format in very creative, brilliant ways to sort of tell your story and to make a point. You know, like think about the stuff of like near the end of Metal Gear Solid 2 when like the death screen happens and it says vision mailed, but you're like still playing inside the little tiny screen inside the big death screen. Like playing with like weird things like that and using the format and the framing of a video game in really creative ways. Like Nier Automata does that all throughout, but as it goes on, it does it more and more and like keeps on upping the ante and sort of how it's playing with itself, how it's telling its story. And like in the big revelation is that it is doing all those brilliant things. It's doing them in ways that are even more creative than what Kojima has managed to do, or I think any other game I've ever seen do. And so it keeps upping the ante in terms of how it's playing with the form, while also still being so on point, so focused at discussing its core sort of big theme, its kind of big philosophical question, which is I mean, it's like the big philosophical question that all android, like, robot fiction is about, of like, what is the purpose? Like, what is the meaning of life? Because robots are in a specific position narratively to sort of, like, investigate that question. And usually I find those narratives extremely unsatisfying because it is a very hard thing to try to tell a story about, because I think, like, the real answer is obviously that there is no real meaning to life. Like, the even posing the question makes a bunch of assumptions that are probably not true. But Nier Automata manages to sort of tackle that big question, tackle that idea, and do it so thoroughly with such grace and insight, and tell it in a way that, like, it would be so impossible to make a movie or a TV show, because you just couldn't do it. It's almost kind of like, in a way, what we were talking about with, like Dunkirk and Christopher Nolan playing with time in terms of how, of, like, using that in, like, the filmic language to say things and do things, or, like, maybe actually probably a better comparison point would be, like, Episode 8 of Twin Peaks, and how that uses the film format of, like, what would a novel adaptation of Episode 8 of Twin Peaks look like, right? Like, there's just what it is, and the story it's telling is so particularly tied to how it is telling it, and that takes so much skill and mastery of the form to be able to do that, that usually when it is done, it is, I feel it is done poorly, like in the case of Kojima. Here, it's just done fucking perfectly all throughout, and it ends on such an unbelievable high note that, yeah, I will leave off with Nier Automata. I'll leave off with two things. First of all, my game of the year list is the number one is not a shoe-in anymore this year. That is what I'm talking about when I'm saying people should really play Nier Automata. That's what I'm fucking saying.
Oh boy.
The other thing I will say, if you are listening to this and you have played Nier Automata, this will make sense to you, because it is probably very frustrating to hear someone talk about this game that is, like, muzzled when you know what it is and you just want to be able to, like, hear it and talk about it, because I'm going to have a real hard time going forward until you fucking play this game, Jonathan, not fucking talking about this shit. But I will say this, at the end of Nier Automata, the game, it sort of poses, let's call it a moral question, some, like, Paragon Renegade type shit from a certain point of view, and it's a yes or no question, and I said yes, motherfucker! I said yes! I don't even know what happens if you say no. I assume the thing it says happens if you say no. I don't know. If you say no, you're a piece of shit. I said yes, goddammit.
I'm excited. Okay, so you're going to make me play this game, basically.
You have to play this game.
Okay. Did you get it on disc or digital?
I got it digitally because it was on sale.
Fuck. Digitally. Okay. I was wondering if I could borrow it.
Yeah.
That's okay. No. That's harder when it's digital. Yeah, we'll figure it out.
It's really fucking good.
I need to play it. What's the progression like? So it is this thing where you kind of, quote-unquote, replay the game, but I know that's a kind of trite way to describe it.
Yeah, that's not the way to think about it. It's, I think not telling you what anything about, like, Route C or past that point is, because that's why I think where, like, the spoiler stuff really happens. I think it's fair to say, like, so Route A is you're playing as Tubi, who's, like, the character that everyone, like, you know, one of the characters on the front of the box, the lady android, and you're playing through, and it's, like, that, the first playthrough of Route A and getting that story is pretty straightforward, like, stuff. It's not the most mind-blowing stuff. I think it's very good, and it, like, it's, but it is setting up a lot of things, and, like, it's important as that, and, like, sort of understanding the setting, the world, the characters, and setting you up to, like, have these sort of assumptions and preconceptions about things, so that when the game sort of plays with it and twists on it, you have that later. So that's kind of what Route A is about. Then Route B, which is your second playthrough, is the same timeline, basically, and it's the same kind of series of events of Route A, but you're playing it from another character's point of view, and so it's complicating things and building on things. And then when you start the game again, after you have seen the credits the second time, then you get into Route C, which is all new stuff, and it's all new stuff from there till the end. So yeah, it's like, it is something where I definitely think the early parts of the game are its roughest, and it's, like, that's where sometimes where the combat is not, I wish the combat was a bit more satisfying, because I think it would make it easier to push through some of the areas of the game that are maybe a bit slow. So if you are playing Nier Automata and you feel like, you know, you're wanting more stuff to happen, I would say it's okay to mainline the game. Like, I enjoyed the game throughout. Like, I really think it has a great sense of presence in it, and the music, and the way the graphics and the way the characters feel and move and animate, and the sound effects and, like, all of that stuff creates this really great sense of, I think, like, being there and just, like, kind of communicating the tone of that world. And so it's something I just like being in Nier Automata. But if, like, you're having a rough time with it, I just, like, just keep on moving because you will hit a point in the main story where it will grab you.
I was going to ask another question.
Okay.
And I've forgotten.
That's unfortunate.
But I think we know your overall opinion.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. No, people should play this game.
Oh, here was my question. How long do you think it takes to finish in general?
It took me about 40 hours total to do the whole thing. That was with, I would say, about 70% of the side quests done. So if you don't do the side quest stuff, which I would also say, like, I enjoyed the side quest stuff generally, but, like, do not feel, like, hyper compelled to do it. There are a couple of side quests that were pretty good. One in particular that does set up some of the stuff that is in the end game in a really clever way. Obviously, I can't tell you which side quest it was because it would kind of spoil where things go. But there's, like, some of the side quests are more interesting, but don't, like, feel like you have to do every single side. It's not like The Witcher 3 or something where, like, that's a huge part of the game.
Or Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth.
Or Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth, exactly. Like that's
we haven't mentioned it in a while, so, you know.
We'll be able to mention it more once the sequel comes out next year. But,
I keep forgetting about that.
But yeah, like, if you feel like, you know, you want to keep on moving through the main story, do not, like, feel like you have to go do every fucking side quest there is.
Okay. Awesome.
Because there was a point once I was deep into Route C where I decided, like, a lot of these side quests are interesting, but I need to just see the story through because it's, like, really grabbed me.
Well, your opinion is the one I trust most.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we wouldn't do this podcast.
Yeah.
So I will find a way to play this game.
Okay, good. Because I do not know how we would be able to have an end of year podcast, and I would not be able to talk about the end of this game because it's
that's a high.
It's so hard, and you will understand when you play it.
Okay, awesome. Splatoon 2. If we want to switch to total gears a little bit, Splatoon 2 is so good. I sometimes just sit back and chuckle to myself at how good this game is, like better than it probably should be. So if you don't know, Splatoon was a game on the Wii U a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
It had kind of a cult following, but like a lot of Wii U games, not a lot of people played it because it's a Wii U game.
Yeah.
So Splatoon 2, I think a lot of people were expecting Nintendo would do like a port for the Switch, like they did for Mario Kart or something. But this is a full sequel. It's got two returning multiplayer maps, but otherwise they're all new single-player mode. There's a new horde mode kind of thing in the game called Salmon Run. So if you've played Splatoon 1 and you're wondering, is this enough new stuff? From my understanding, again, I did not play Splatoon 1, but I've looked it up and because I'm now into Splatoon 2. It is a different game, and that's cool. And if you haven't played Splatoon 1 and you're worried about, is Splatoon 2 kind of hard to get into? No. I think it kind of assumes that you haven't played the first one. It tutorializes you just fine without being overbearing. And there's such a wealth of stuff to do in the game that from moment one you feel like there's so many areas you can go play with the game and have fun with it that it's really easy to just get into the rhythms in different ways over the course of the game. But anyway, I bought Splatoon 2 on kind of a whim because on release day, I'd heard people talking about it. It looked fun, and I had not started a new game in a while. I'd kind of tried playing Horizon Zero Dawn, and I wasn't getting into it. So I don't know if that's the game or my own mood at the time, but I was like, I'd really like to play Splatoon 2. I also have not had like a multiplayer-heavy game I've played in a while. And while playing Destiny 2, I was kind of, they're very different games, Destiny and Splatoon, but it was like I kind of wanted to scratch that itch a little bit, and Destiny wouldn't be out until September. So I picked up Splatoon 2 on the Switch. And it is so good. And I think some of my things I want to say about the game will probably be a retread if you've played Splatoon 1, because this obviously is not a brand new game. It is a sequel. But I do think it is a pretty exceptional game. And, you know, I tweeted about this, and it's my number one thought on the game is that if you own a Nintendo Switch, you should own Splatoon 2. It's just a game that, like, kind of like Breath of the Wild or Mario Kart 8 Deluxe or something. It's just one of those Nintendo games that should have a weird 110% attach rate. Because I don't know why, if you like Nintendo enough to buy their console, you wouldn't enjoy Splatoon 2. It is such a fun game, and it is also such a weird game. Like, I love that Nintendo, for their first new IP since, like, Pikmin or something 15 years ago, went like, okay, we're going to have squids, but they're also kids, but they can turn back into the squids, and they shoot ink. Where does the ink come from? I don't know, inside their body or something. It's weird. And then
their ejaculate, I think we can safely say.
Pretty much, yeah. And, you know, they have their guns to shoot the ink ejaculate, and then they can turn into squids and soak up their own ink, but the ink stays on the ground. That's a little weird. And it's a multiplayer game, and we're Nintendo. We're not really known for online multiplayer, but for some weird reason, we're savants at it when we want to be. Like, we seem like we're not that good at it, but then when we really put ourselves, our our minds to it, we're very good at it. And so it's got this incredible multiplayer mode with this game type that seems a little too simplistic on the surface, Turf War, where you just have to paint more of the map than the others. And then you get into it and you're like, oh, this is legitimately one of the most competitive multiplayer suites I have ever played, in the sense that I have had multiple matches in like one afternoon where victory is determined by 0.2 percentage point. Like, at the end of the map, match, it shows you how much of your map you've splatted in your color versus the opponent, and it's the percentage of the map is what you win on. And multiple times, I have won or lost by, like, less than a half of a percentage point. And that is a unique thrill that I do not get in Destiny. I'd get in Halo sometimes back in the day, never in Call of Duty, which is always a blowout one way or another. It's like that sense of, like, up to the clock going out, it's like, I don't know who won. That's a unique thrill. And that's only one of the multiplayer modes in the main unranked area. And, you know, if you go up enough, you can do ranked matches, which have other kind of modes, which is, like, you know, their weird versions of Capture the Flag and stuff, and all of this. And then there's a whole single-player campaign, which I didn't know about. That's actually what made me buy the game, finally, was no one talked about that in Splatoon 1.
Right.
No one's talking about it in Splatoon 2. It's amazing. It's a full single-player thing where it's got a series of worlds, almost like Mario, and each world has a couple of levels. And in the overworld for each world, you have to do these interesting platforming challenges to get to the levels, which I really love, almost like in a Mario 64 kind of way, but with squid ejaculate. And then you get to the levels, and each level kind of gives you a different gun and uses a different set of gear in the game and has built this whole cool linear level around. And it's a really fun way to, one, just get to know the game. Like, I've definitely learned, like, oh, this is how I use the roller or something, and then I'll bring that into multiplayer and be better with it. So that's really great and useful. But it's also just, it is classic Nintendo, very good 3D platforming stuff, but with this, you know, third-person shooter sort of thing that Nintendo has never really done in anything else. A little bit in, I don't know, Luigi's Mansion in a weird way. Sure. But not really.
Mario Sunshine.
Kind of, yes.
The third-person platformer.
And so, like, yeah, the single-player mode is so worth playing on its own. And then there's the whole thing they've added called Salmon Run, which is this game's variant on a horde mode. And I thought I never needed to see another game try a horde mode again in my fucking life, because we've done that to death.
Right.
But they have a very fun way of doing it. You go in with four people, and basically you have to defend this site, and you also have to go out and kill the enemies as they come in and take these orbs and bring them back to the site. And it is just, it's a ton of fun. I kind of wish there was a version of it that was more endless, like Gears of War Horde, where, like, you kept going to, like, wave 20 or something, and it gets really hard. This is three waves, and they could alter it. We'll see. So Splatoon 1, I know, had a very active post, you know, release development from Nintendo, and Splatoon 2 is on a console people actually own.
Right.
So I think it'll probably be even more supported. But so Salmon Run is fun, and there's all these little things to explore in the world. So that was one of my biggest takeaways, is that Splatoon 2 is surprisingly feature-rich. Like, I've had it for a couple of days now, and there's still sections I have not done a lot with. Meanwhile, I have not gotten tired at all of Turf War, and I've played like 60 matches of that, because they're 3 minutes apiece, and you would think that would make it kind of shallow, and it doesn't. Like, the time just, you want to just keep playing and keep playing, because even if you are on a losing streak, it's a losing streak of these simple 3 minute matches, and it could turn around at any time, and it's just very, very addictive and fun. So yeah, I think the controls are great. It does start you off with motion controls, and they are some of the weirdest motion controls I've seen, where what it does is, if you're playing with, like, the pro controller, let's say, your left stick moves your character, as you would expect. Your right stick, on the X-axis, you can move it. So, like, just turning your camera left, right.
Right.
But to move your gun, your reticle up and down, that's using the motion controls for. And I could not, like, the motion controls are fine, like, they work technically just fine, but I couldn't get over the cognitive dissonance of one axis is a button or a stick, and one axis is motion. That's too weird. But you can turn that off, and then it's like a normal shooter, and it's fine. So the controls are very good. This game makes amazing use of HD Rumble on the Pro Controller and the Joy-Cons. HD Rumble, I've talked about before. It sounds like a stupid Nintendo gimmick. It isn't. And what Splatoon 2 shows is, it's not always about making really big, bombastic rumble. It's about all these little subtle things it does in the world. Like, when you're riding on ink on one of the little rail systems in the single player, it's the subtlest little rumble I've ever felt out of a controller. But it's those little things that add a lot to it. And then I love the music in this game. You heard a little selection of it as our theme song this week. And I actually looked up, the composer of this game is Toru Minagishi, who's one of the main Nintendo composers of the 2000s.
Huh.
This is that, when you're listening to Splatoon 2, keep in mind, Toru Minagishi wrote the music for Twilight Princess. Which is, that dude has range.
Yeah.
That's an amazing difference. And he also has done some Mario games and stuff, but it's like, Yeah, he is kind of Nintendo's catch-all guy for music these days, I get the sense. But anyway, and the graphics are absolutely gorgeous. You know, the Nintendo Switch, not the most powerful console on the market, but the games I've played on there are really good looking. And Splatoon 2 is another one. My brother was watching me play it and looking at all like the paint effects and everything that comes out of the ink you squirt out and everything. And he said, man, they should really do a Super Mario Sunshine remake. And I was thinking the same thing, because like it's got some of those qualities of like these very colorful graphics and all that paint stuff that Mario Sunshine does. And it's like, yeah, that game would actually hold up really well if you like did it with modern graphics
except effects. But Super Mario Sunshine is the exact opposite. Super Mario Sunshine is you going around and trying to clean up all the paint.
That's true.
So you don't want the paint to look that good, because you want it to look like something you want to get rid of.
Yes. No, you do make an incredible mess in Splatoon 2 everywhere good. You go. I love the multiplayer maps. They're all very good. Some are better than others, as with any multiplayer suite, but there's a lot of strategy involved in all of them. And I also think, in terms of the online functionality, mostly Nintendo has nailed this, I think, very impressively. Like, this is as smooth a matchmaking system as I have ever encountered. You go into the multiplayer lobby, you're in a match like that, 10 seconds. It's very fast. And when in between matches, as soon as it has 8 people, which it does very, very fast, it populates very quickly, you're in a match. So you are incentivized to keep playing by the simple fact that there are so few barriers. You're not waiting on your phone while you're waiting for a match to start. It just moves through things very, very quickly in all the modes I've played. So I really love that about it. I've only had a couple of instances of like dropout from network connectivity, and that was almost certainly on my end, because our internet has been really spotty lately. And I'm playing this on Wi-Fi. Everything else I play in my house I have on Ethernet, but the Switch, for obvious reasons, doesn't have an Ethernet port.
Right.
So, yeah, that's very impressive. There are some things I've seen people bitch about with the online that I don't really agree with. Like, Nintendo does some things differently in that, for instance, in the main lobby for, like, Turf War, there's 2 maps at a time that you can play in, and every 2 hours, those 2 maps in the hopper change.
Right.
And that is unusual. Normally you would have a hopper with all your maps, but I think it accomplishes a few things. One, there is something fun of, because these matches are so short, having like, okay, I'm going to go in now, and until 6 o'clock it's these 2 maps. You really get to know those maps, and it's like your strategy kind of deepens, and you can feel the matches getting closer as you play. I would also guess that in some way that allows Nintendo to keep the networks very smooth, and that there's less things they have being changing around in there. I don't know the technicalities of that, but I mean, they do that all over Splatoon 2. So like the ranked matches you do, the game type of matches change every 2 hours. And Salmon Run is not open all of the time. It's open at particular times. Not like very precise, but like this day for all 12 hours or something.
Okay, yeah.
But maybe not the next day. And again, I would guess that that means that they're not stretching themselves too thin and servicing too much at any given time. And it means that like if Salmon Run is up, everyone's going to that, and it's going to be a healthy population for that, which you need because it is a 4-player cooperative thing. So all of that works very well. I have not tried to use the voice chat stuff. Obviously,
right, yeah.
It's a complete fucking fiasco mess.
Yeah.
I get that. Technically, it's better than it was in Splatoon 1, which had no option at all. But, you know, you still...
Sure.
You're probably... I mean, you can... If you don't need the voice chat thing, you can do local wireless with people. You can make your own lobbies for Salmon Run or other things. So if you have 3 friends or something and you want to get in and play these game types together, all of that is in there. It is the voice chat thing that is the weird odd man out. Your best bet probably isn't even the Nintendo app. I just get Skype out and, you know,
sure. Yeah.
The Wi-Fi call. Like, that's going to be just as easy as whatever the Nintendo... I have the Nintendo app, but I have not used it because... The only other person I kind of know who has a Switch is my brother, and he doesn't have Splatoon 2, so, yeah.
Right.
Anyway, so that's my thought. Like, overall, again, Nintendo is always going to Nintendo in some ways.
Right, yeah.
But that means they're always going to Nintendo in other ways, which means very creative, very polished games, and, you know, this is a third-person shooter, quote-unquote, in a, you know, it's a genre we kind of know, but they have done it in such a creative, singular Nintendo way. It is a game with so much to do and so much fun. I was a little put off by the $60 price tag before I bought it. And now that I'm playing it, I'm like, yeah, this is a full $60 game. I wouldn't be scared by that. You'll get your value out of it. It's outstanding. It's very, very good. I thought it would just be a diversion. This will be on my top 10 shortlist. I'm not going to say it's going to unseat Persona 5, but...
Well, you still haven't played Nier Automata yet.
But, yeah, it's a very, very good game, and another one where I'm very happy to have a Switch, because this is another one that's very fun to take out of the dock and play around the house or elsewhere. Obviously, if you're out on the road or something, you probably won't be playing Wi-Fi stuff, but it's got that whole single-player mode that I'm 3 worlds in, and it's very, very good. So
awesome. Yeah, like Splatoon is always... Obviously, I haven't played it because I didn't have a Wii U, and I don't have a Switch yet, but... like, Splatoon was always something I was just, like, really happy to see Nintendo doing it, because it was, like, there was just that long, long stretch with Nintendo of, like, the latter Wii years and the most of the Wii U, where it's just, like, they just were putting the same. There's, like, new Super Mario Bros. 60. It was just, like, fucking God, Jesus Christ, do something new. And then all of a sudden it was, like, Super Mario Maker and Splatoon and, like, the Captain Toad game. It's, like, all of a sudden they just felt, like, oh, yeah, you're making new games. And it's, like, yeah, like, something really different. And it feels like that's continued with the Switch, with Zelda obviously being something really different. It seems like Super Mario Odyssey is going to be something very different.
They have ARMS this summer,
yeah,
also.
Yeah, ARMS. Like, it's just, it's nice to see Nintendo, like, really kind of, like, taking their game design philosophy stuff and moving it towards different genres, like with the third-person shooters. I'm doing something creative with it. So I'm hoping that means in 2 or 3 years we get Splatreen.
Yeah.
And then we just get to keep this new franchise alive until we get tired of it, like we got tired of the rest of them.
I'll say this, you know, knowing that Nintendo has really supported Splatoon 1 well over the years in terms of how they added new maps and modes and stuff and new events, they're probably going to do that with Splatoon 2. And I think it was very smart to start with a new Splatoon game on the Switch. It's there, you know, in the launch year. So, like, if you get it now, this game will probably be supported for a very long time. And, you know, Nintendo has done really well with the DLC they've put out for games. I don't know if there will be paid DLC or not for Splatoon 2. Right. But whatever they add, I do expect, like, this is an investment that will be fun now and will probably continue to be fun for a couple years to come. And that's awesome. So, the Switch is having a really good launch year. Like, I want to stress that. I have never bought launch hardware and used it this much within the first year. You've got Zelda. You've got the Mario Kart port. You've got Splatoon 2. I have not played ARMS myself, but people seem to like that game okay. They put that out. You got Mario Odyssey coming out. You've got a bunch of cool indie games on there already. Yeah. It's a very well-supported system, not necessarily in terms of it's got, like, the most games ever, but the games it has are of pretty high quality. And we've still got Mario to come. We've got Fire Emblem Warriors this year at some point. Right. There's just, you know, Sonic Mania is going to be on here as well as the other consoles. Sonic Forces, if that ever comes out. So, a lot of cool stuff, and that's just in this first launch year, and that's pretty crazy to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when I got, like, the Wii, for instance, and it was Twilight Princess and Wii Sports for a year.
You know? What about that hot game Red Steel, or other Wii launch game?
Wii version of Modern Warfare.
Sure, the Wii version of Modern Warfare.
Did you know they did the entire Modern Warfare trilogy on Wii?
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
There is somebody out there right now who that is what Call of Duty is to them, is the Wii version of the Modern Warfare games.
There's gotta be a Reddit thread somewhere of some hipster insisting that's the best way to play Modern Warfare 2.
That argument is happening at this very moment.
Yes. Alright. You want to talk some Twin Peaks?
Twin Peaks.
Sean.
Yeah.
How happy did this episode make you?
I mean, it made me happy. I mean, it made me really sad and, like uncertain.
That's true.
In myself, in the world at first. And then, you know, then it was like a nice cherry pie. So,
it is true. This episode structurally is very well done in that, as you said earlier, it's kind of, we have two or three stories that we watch. We don't really intercut a lot. It ends on some of the most fun stuff the show has ever done.
Just some of the most happiest and heartwarming scenes, you know?
Yes. But it does start with some of the darkest stuff the show has ever done.
Uh-huh.
So, why don't we start there? And we can build to Dougie Jones.
Exactly.
Yeah. Alright, as the episode does. So, spoilers from here on out for episode 11 of Twin Peaks, which is named There's Fire Where You Are Going. Or that's the description.
Sure, yeah.
I like to think of those as the titles, because they're fun.
Yeah.
So much good stuff in here. But yes, we start with a long section on Shelley and Bobby's broken family.
Yeah.
We learn here.
Yeah, we find out Bobby is the dad to Amanda Seyfried's character.
Becky.
Yes, Becky.
Yeah, so Shelley and Bobby were clearly married at some point. They had Becky. They are not married anymore, which I think you would expect. Shelley and Bobby were never going to be a forever couple.
No.
Shelley's
going to Shelley.
Yeah, we're going to talk about all the good stuff they do here. The thing that blew me away in this episode more than anything else is just how good David Lynch is, and Mark Frost in the script, with small character details.
Uh-huh.
Because it's amazing how little formal exposition there is for any of the returning characters in Twin Peaks. Like, we only learned last week that Richard is of the Horn family, and we still don't know whose son he actually is. We suspect it's Audrey, but we don't know. Here is the first time that Becky called Shelley mom, that we saw that Shelley and Bobby did have something going on, that they had a family at some point. We see that, you know, Becky is in this horribly abusive relationship. We see that Shelley and Bobby don't really know how to deal with it. And then we learn all these other things, I think, about Shelley and Bobby as people, as adults.
Yeah.
And all of it is through action. All of it is through glances. Most of it is nonverbal. I think there's some really incredible filmmaking and acting here.
Yeah.
Someone said this on Twitter the other day, and I agree with it 100%. Dana Ashbrook is giving one of the year's best TV performances, and I don't think I would have expected that, because he's very good on the original Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
But I was not prepared for, I think, just how interesting he's playing the character here, especially because he's not been, like, a huge presence in TV since Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's done stuff, I'm just not familiar with it. So, but yeah, I mean, everyone is good here, though. I imagine Amick and Amanda Seyfried, this whole section is incredible. So you want to go through it here?
Yeah, let's go through it.
We start on the mountains of Twin Peaks.
Yes.
I'm always surprised when we start an episode in the town limits of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Because that's still, frankly, kind of rare. I love, there's this really interesting shot that I think sets up the episode very well, where you have from the POV of someone watching these kids playing catch, and the camera is following the movements of the ball.
Yeah.
At one point, a kid runs into the street to get the ball, and I got very worried for him.
Yeah, I literally said out loud, and I was like watching this by myself at night, and I just, as soon as that happened, I said out loud, I can't see a kid get hit by a car get David Lynch.
I know.
And luckily, that didn't happen. But no. Like, obviously, he was like playing with that tension.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
He knows he traumatized all of us deeply.
Yeah.
But I think that shot is important because one of the things this episode does is it's very kinetic filmmaking. And by that, I mean the camera moves.
Yeah.
Big things happen in terms of movement and spatial relations. And I don't usually think of David Lynch as that kind of director. His right. directing is kind of still. Big things happen, but it's not like kind of in-your-face kinetic in the way this episode is with like Shelley on the roof of the car
right.
and the gun being fired and all the craziness that happens in this episode, like with Cole and the portal and everything. But that shot is actually, I think, kind of a thesis statement artistically for the episode, where you have the camera following the ball, and it is this very kinetic shot.
Yeah.
But they basically, they find Miriam, the murdered, well, not murdered, because she's still
almost
alive,
murdered.
Almost murdered, woman from last week who Richard beat the shit out of. She's all bloodied up after last week, but not dead. This actually does not come back up again in this episode, interestingly.
Yeah.
But
it sets up the tone, you
very
know,
well.
Very, very particularly. It's like, it's what David Lynch does all throughout the series is, you know, by having, like, there's all these different plot threads going on at once, and they are not necessarily interconnected in this episode in particular. They're not interconnected at all, but they are all building on each other emotionally and, mm-hmm. and thematically.
Yeah. My notes are in much longer paragraphs this week because we cut less.
Exactly.
All right, so we go to the Double R Diner. Oh, no, we don't, actually. We have one scene at the Fat Trout trailer park where Amanda Seyfried, Becky, is on the phone. Something really bad is going on. She screams and grabs a fucking gun.
Yeah.
So that's crazy. But anyway, at the Double R Diner, Shelley gets a call from Becky. This is where Becky calls her mom. So it's our first official confirmation, their mother-daughter, which, again, we'll talk about this later, but those that interesting generational thing here of Shelley Leo and now Becky, whatever this
asshole.
Asshole. And, you know, like, are we going to see who Becky's Bobby might be or something?
Right.
Or, you know, who? What would that be? And obviously, Bobby went through quite an evolution, so
yeah.
We'll see. Anyway, yeah, Becky gets that gun from under the couch as Shelley pulls up to help her out. And Becky just full-on steals her mom's keys, is shouting, I hate him, over and over again, and drives off with a gun. Seems like a very dangerous circumstance. And Shelley jumps on the fucking hood.
Yeah.
And it's like the movie... Death Proof, the Quentin Tarantino movie where you have the stunt woman on the hood
right.
of the car, but instead it's Shelley and her daughter winds up flinging her off the car, which is a very intense sequence.
Yeah. It's like one of like a number of moments in this episode where I was like really convinced that a main character was about to die.
Yeah.
I think like it's very impressive that David, like none of them do in this episode, but David Lynch has managed to make this series so unpredictable, intense, and like dark in when it needs to be dark that like I was fully prepared multiple times for this through this episode like, oh fuck, this character's dead now. This is gonna be the end.
Yep. Then the Harry Dean Stanton character, Carl, comes up to Shelley.
Yeah.
And I love him in this episode.
Yeah, Harry Dean Stanton, much bigger presence in the show than I thought he was going to be.
Given that he has one scene in Firewalk
yeah,
with Me?
Exactly.
Hey, if you have access to Harry Dean Stanton, you use Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely not complaining.
Yeah. So he comes up to Shelley. He's like, are you okay, sweetheart? And she tells him what's going on. And he pulls out like a flute or something. And she asks for a ride. And he like whistles this flute. And a Volkswagen van comes over. And so they're driving along after after Becky. And she goes, can we go any faster, Carl? And he says, I want to get there in one piece, Shelley. And you can tell, like, these two go back a ways, like, as friends. Like, they're both aware of all the problems Becky's been having. It seems like Carl keeps an eye on Becky for them. And Carl asks the question, why don't you just call Bobby? Which gives us the indication, okay, this Bobby relationship went somewhere. And so Shelley, who her last name is Briggs here, I guess, is still Briggs because she still has Bobby's last name. So that's where we kind of learn that. Again, Lynch reveals these character details very casually and in due time. Shelley was in episode 1, remember.
Exactly.
This is episode 11. We learn her history since the last 25 years. Anyway, so they call Bobby, and to do this, Carl pulls out a police radio that is just in his van. And I love that the people on the other end of the line don't take that as weird. Carl just calls them up. He seems like he doesn't abuse it.
No.
But he does have a police radio in his van, and that's bizarre. Anyway, we cut to the interior of this little hotel or apartment complex. Becky storms in. She goes to room 208. She's banging on the door yelling for Steven, who is her shitbag boyfriend. Yes. I did get that down here. The woman next door tells her they just left. And so Becky just starts shouting, "Fuck you, Steven!" and fires several shots into the door.
Yeah.
This is the best thing Amanda Seyfried's ever done.
It's pretty fucking amazing.
Oh, it's so good. I want a spinoff where she just goes into hotels and shoots stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's awesome. Then there's this, again, a very kinetic shot where we have this like moving shot, like a disembodied POV of someone we don't know.
I mean, it's basically like an Evil Dead shot.
Very much an Evil Dead shot where it jumps through the hotel, down the stairs, and Steven and this woman he's probably cheating on Becky with are at the bottom of the stairwell hiding.
Yes. It sets up a very similar opposite shot later in the episode of a stairwell and ominous figures.
So we do, after this, have a long section with Gordon Cole in South Dakota, but I'm going to jump ahead and let's continue talking about Bobby, Shelley, and Becky. Because after we kind of breathe from all this zaniness for a while, we do come back to Bobby, Shelley, and Becky at the diner. And I think the scene that follows is a beautiful, nuanced, scary portrait of domestic abuse and these two parents who are really just trying to deal with it as best they can, but knowing that they can't save their daughter if she doesn't want to be saved in some way.
Yeah.
So, and you get a lot of character history here. So clearly Becky has been with this guy for some time, and she's been acting out in a lot of ways. Bobby and Shelley are both kind of at their wits' end. Bobby, you know, tells her that he couldn't have got her out of this if he wasn't a cop, and they're going to have to pay for that door. And then you learn that Becky has been borrowing a lot of money from her mom. She can't, like, she doesn't want any more, but Bobby finally offers her some money, tells her, you know, she's got to make this right, got to get Becky away from Steven. And even though in the first half of this scene, Becky was saying she really wants out of this, now she starts sticking up for Steven, and she's going back and forth. And I thought the nuance here was really interesting, because we've talked a lot in the series so far about how clearly domestic violence and misogynistic violence is a major theme of the new Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And it was a major theme of the old Twin Peaks. That's the original sin of Twin Peaks universe. And I was saying, like, I'm interested to see, you know, how this starts becoming more a part of the text. And I think it does here.
Yeah,
where you spend time with the victim, with the Amanda Seyfried character, and you see, you know, the pain that's been wrought on her is that she is so confused inside. She hates this guy. She knows he's terrible for her. But she also has that attraction. And she has that sense of, like, no, I can make him better. We can fix this. I don't want to run away from this. I don't want to admit that this thing didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and there's all these warring things. And I love that it never comes down to one point. She never is completely like, no, he never hit me. And she's never like, no, I want to get away from him 100%. And, you know, obviously I cannot speak as a victim of domestic abuse, but I feel like from what I've, you know, seen and read of those things, that seems like a pretty accurate portrayal of how these things tend to work out.
Yeah, that it's just, there's, like you said, there's no, from that person's point of view, there's like no right answer. There's no one direction to go, because on the one hand, you do, or at least have convinced yourself that you love this person, and then on the other hand, there's part of you that obviously understands that what is happening is not right and is not acceptable, but you don't know how to navigate those two contradictions in a lot of ways. Yeah, and it definitely presents that in a complex way.
And I love Shelley and Bobby here, who have some distance between themselves. It doesn't seem like they have a lot of acrimony. Maybe it's been a many years since the divorce or something. But, like, they're both sharing all these knowing glances of, like, you know, if they're unified by anything, they clearly love their daughter and they don't know what to do about this.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. And Bobby does kind of the macho thing of, like, you know, I will arrest this guy. I'll bring him down if he touches you again. And then Shelley has this really nice little thing she says, where she says, look, Becky, we know you're a grown married woman, but we're your parents and we love you and we just don't want to lose you. And when she says that, this thing kind of unlocks in Becky, and she remembers about when her mom was on the hood of the car and, like, everything that happened. And she kind of breaks down. It's like, it snaps out of it. It's like, I'm so sorry. I love you, Mom. And I love that too, that there is, there's so much tension in this relationship, but there is a lot of love at that table too. And it's a really interesting, again, varied, nuanced portrait. There's a million things going on between the characters in that scene.
Yeah, they convey the sense of the family, even though like that family has been disrupted.
Yeah.
Yeah, in that moment, it snaps back into place.
Yep. I also love that throughout that scene, we're cutting over to Norma at the counter.
Yeah.
You know, the owner of the Double R Diner, kind of looking at kind of who these people are, kind of like her kids, because right. She kind of helped raise Shelley, you get the sense of, and watching this unfold. And she has this peculiar expression on her face where you get the sense like maybe she's lived through something like this and she's beyond it now or something. But she can look back and kind of see like here are these people in the middle of this kind of fraught situation and she's kind of looking over them. But I liked that a lot.
Yeah.
Norma has not had a ton to do in the series so far, but I like having her there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, then this scene is interrupted because a dude walks up to the window. It's another guy in a leather jacket, like Bobby.
Yeah.
And apparently that's Shelley's new boyfriend because Shelley snaps right back into, like, 18-year-old Shelley mode and is immediately outside making out with the guy and, like, making plans to meet him. And I love throughout this scene, like, for one, Matt Janamek is very funny in that moment. Mm-hmm. I love the detail of, like, he's clearly, like, Bobby, too. But, like, a Bobby who didn't grow up.
Right, yeah, it's old Bobby.
Yeah. Like, Bobby still wears his leather jacket, but he wears it responsibly.
Exactly. You know, he's an officer of the law.
Yes, and he's dedicated to his job. But, no, but I love that, like, Bobby is kind of taken aback, but then Becky just gives him this knowing look, like, isn't this terrible? Like, clearly they've been through this before.
Yeah.
Like, something's going on. Like, I get the sense that, like, clearly Shelley has matured in a lot of ways, but maybe not in this one.
Uh-huh.
And maybe she still has this weakness for these kind of guys.
Yeah.
Which I think kind of makes sense given the Shelley we knew mm-hmm. 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. It is a very funny scene, but it's also a sad scene because it is that, like,
yeah,
she couldn't grow out of this sort of, like, affection for people that are probably not very good for her.
Right. Shelley comes back to the table, and she's, like, grinning like a schoolgirl, which is funny. And then a gunshot just breaks through the window.
Yeah, the scene takes a real fucking turn.
It does. And I love how Bobby jumps into action. It's one of those scenes where, and again, all of Bobby's character development has been through these moments of action.
Yeah.
Not literally, like, firing a gun, but I mean, like, things where he has action in the story. And he's, you know, he goes out in the street, his gun drawn, he's trying to figure this out. And the situation is very strange on a number of levels.
Yeah.
Because he goes out into the street and there's a family in a minivan and a woman yelling at her husband because their little kid fired the shot because there was a gun in the back seat. And
like the dad is just kind of standing there saying nothing, and the mom is just freaking out.
Also,
understandably,
notably, the father looks exactly like the kind of guy who would leave a gun in the back seat.
Yes,
which feels like a little bit of Lynch political commentary for us.
Yeah.
But there is a phenomenal revolving shot as Bobby takes the gun from the mom and it revolves around him as he unloads and, like, takes the gun apart. And he's just, like, kind of shaking through it because, like, this is a pretty high-pressure thing and he doesn't want the gun to go off again. Wonderful cinematography there. And throughout all this, you have these police lights flashing, this really dynamic lighting. The kid looks kind of messed up and sad. Bobby is confused. There's horns honking all over the place.
Yeah.
It's a really, like, tense scene, even though by the time he's taking that gun apart, we know what happened, and it's not that big a deal. But it's, in that Lynchian way, so off-putting.
Yeah, because it's just something, this whole sequence and then where it goes after this is so, like, because it's something where, like, when that shot fires, like, you're trained as you know, the people who've seen movies and TV shows before, of, like, oh, God, like, they're coming to, like, kill Bobby, or maybe, like, or, like, it's a retaliation for what Becky did, shooting at that door, and, like, there's, like, something going on that, like, one of our main characters is the target of some sort of attack, and that's what this scene is. It's another scene where, when Bobby went out there, I was like, oh, fuck, Bobby's gonna get killed, and that's gonna, like, throw the whole, like, plan of going to that, like, one place or whatever into confusion. It's like, I'm just very convinced that all these characters are gonna die at some point. It's just, it's dire. It's like a very dire tone. But when Bobby goes out there, what you discover is that that's not the case at all. It was just pure random happenstance that he happened to be there, that we happened to be witnessing the scene while this other series of events happened, like, over in the road where this kid accidentally shot a gun because it was in the backseat of the car and he didn't really know what he's doing. Or maybe he did know what he's doing because he's got a kind of, like, very shitty expression on his face that he's given to Bobby. And that, like, since it's just like this whole scene where it goes just gives the sense of, like, the world is just kind of falling apart. Like, it's just everything is unraveling, that it's like gunshots are just going out for basically no reason, and like this kid just accidentally fires a gun and could have easily killed someone.
I also think as Lynch is painting a portrait of all these evils of rural America,
right,
or middle America or whatever we're calling Twin Peaks, having an episode with these echoes of gun violence is an interesting one.
Yeah.
And it's about the kind of casual gun violence of like Becky doesn't kill anyone. She knows there's no one in there. All this stuff. The kid fires into a, you know, he could have hit someone, but he doesn't. But it is like this just casual, like, you know, there's guns lying around everywhere and Americans are stupid.
Yeah.
It's kind of the underlying theme of this, I think. So that's interesting. This other cop comes to help out. And so Bobby goes to stop this woman who is incessantly honking her horn. And this scene is bizarre.
Yes.
Because you have this older woman and she is just shouting hysterically at Bobby, including a line, "We're late! We have miles to go! Please, we have to get home!
Yeah.
She's sick!" And up until this point, this scene reminded me of, have you ever seen The Straight Story?
No.
That's one of Lynch's movies from, I think, 1999. It's a Disney movie, technically, which
right,
I love.
Okay.
There's a David Lynch DVD with the Disney logo on it.
There
great. But anyway, The Straight Story, I recommend it highly. Best movie ever made about the state of Iowa. Love it. It's a great film. It's like, you know, we talk about the warmth in Lynch productions.
Mm-hmm.
It's that at feature length.
Cool.
And it's great. But there is this section that is very weird where the main character is driving in his tractor down the road, which is the plot of The Straight Story. And this woman, like a businesswoman, drives by, stops her car, and just gets out and starts ranting like she's like can't take the pressure anymore. It's very reminiscent of that. But the Straight Story does not include a weird kid possessed by the devil vomiting viscous fluid out
yeah.
of his mouth.
All of a sudden, like, it turns into a fucking, like, J-horror movie.
Yep.
Like, this kid just sort of, like, rises out of the passenger seat from, like, the darkness where you can't see them, comes into frame, and it's just, like a zombie sticking her hands out and then just vomit, like, coming out of her mouth.
I love how this scene resolves, which is that it doesn't, and Bobby is just freaked the fuck out, but doesn't know what to do, and we
yeah.
cut, and we actually don't go back to this.
Yeah, you don't. That's like the last time you see Bobby is just like this close-up on his face, just like not knowing how to process what he's seeing in front of him. And it's just, it is this like sense of like Armageddon or something,
yes.
the apocalypse, like of just like I said, like the world is just unraveling, and gunshots are just going off. And there's just chaos and noise and violence that's not, like, aimed or directed or purposeful in any way. And then there's just this person that is, like, dissolving in this car. And it's just, like, and this other person is just incoherently angry about it, I guess. But, like, her and the zombie lady almost don't even seem like they actually exist in the same reality at all. Like, it's this just very fractured, disjointed moment that's incredibly unsettling.
I do like what you said about these hints of like an Armageddon type of feeling that like the world, like in all these corners of the show, there are things that feel like, you know, signs of the apocalypse.
Yeah.
Coming. Like I would not be surprised if we get like a rain of frogs at some point.
Exactly.
You know, something fucking biblical, which we already frankly got in episode 8.
Exactly.
So.
Fucking frog locusts. That's what we're in for because that's what we got.
And we do have a lot of connections to that. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
I do want to talk while we're in the town of Twin Peaks. Let's talk about the scene at the sheriff's department.
Right, yeah.
Very nice scene here. We have Hawk and Truman are looking at the location Briggs left for them, the Colonel Briggs,
yeah.
on the GPS, like on the computer. And then Hawk pulls out this very old map that looks like it's a sheepskin map or
yeah.
something. And he says, "This map is always current. It is a living thing." And it's like an heirloom or something.
Yeah.
He points to this drawing of mountains and he says he thinks it will lead them there. And, or a mound or something, and Truman asks, like, is it a campfire? And he says, it's not a campfire, it's a fire symbol. It's a type of fire, more like modern-day electricity. And Truman says, is that good? Depends. Depends upon the intention behind the fire. Hawk is the best.
Yes, yeah.
Hawk is so great. So this is, we'll talk more about this scene in a second, but I love this. It's like a type of fire, more like modern-day electricity. Knowing Lynch's utter fascination with electricity and electrical
right,
currents,
yeah.
of which there's a lot in this season up to and including Dale Cooper being reborn through an electrical outlet.
Exactly, but except for his shoes. His shoes can't come through.
That's true. This is definitely not a coincidence.
No,
here.
Yeah, it is definitely a very purposeful
line.
Yeah.
But I love that. So they talk about how the date that they're going to go is the day after tomorrow. So Hawk points to these stars on the map where he finds the same date, which refers to corn, which is fertility. But this fertility symbol is black, diseased, death. And he says if you put these two symbols together, you get this, gesturing to a black fire.
Black fire.
Yeah. That made me think of the Black Lodge
sure.
kind of idea, yeah. Just in terms of some of the symbolism in the show. But I do like that they're setting up this whole thing like, I think they're going to see some weird shit when they get to this location.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't say. I thought they'd just show up and camp out under the stars and eat s'mores and, you know, tell tales around the campfire. Yeah.
But anyway, very cool thing here. And then here's how this thing with the map ends, is Truman finds this one little symbol on the map that was also on Briggs' papers. And he says, well, what's that, Hawk? And Hawk says, Frank, you don't ever want to know about that, really. Is that something that we will just leave as a mystery? Or will that come back?
I don't fucking know, man. Like, I have to say this every single episode. There's no person on the planet that has the capacity to predict this show.
That's very true. There's a great scene. I love this scene. I love Hawk so much. Hawk is a character who shouldn't work as well as he does because it is a lot of, like, Native American archetypes he's playing into. But I think, you know, Michael Horse is so good at it and imbues so much kind of naturalism and humanity into it. And, you know, he is a Native American, and just knowing how much he loves the role and stuff helps with that too. But it is like, it feels very sincere. It doesn't feel like Disney's Peter Pan or something.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. It's very thoughtful and purposeful about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but anyway, that's an interesting scene. And then following that is the log lady calls on the phone.
Right. Yeah.
She knows that Hawk found something. And Hawk says, yeah, it's just like you said. I'm sorry. I should have let you know. And she asks, what did you find? And he says he can't tell her that. And then she says, my log is afraid of fire. There's fire where you are going, Hawk. There's fire where you are going. That's pretty ominous.
Yeah.
Because one, Miss Margaret Lanterman has been very correct about things so far this season.
That is true.
Her predictions have been on point.
Yeah.
And then that whole thing with the map and the black fire. And that fire is symbolically here connected with basically what I read is like whatever that other realm is that we've been seeing, they're going to clearly access this.
Yeah.
And it's so fascinating because we also see this with the Gordon Cole stuff we'll talk about in a minute. In the course of the show, really the only character who goes to the Red Room in these places is Cooper.
Right.
And a little bit, you know, disembodied Laura Palmer and things like that. But it's Cooper. It feels like everyone else is going to learn about this by the end of the season.
Right.
And that's
yeah.
fascinating. Like, this season could end with a mass convergence like Ghostbusters, where, like, all the spirits from this other world wind up coming in and taking over our Earth. And it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, then, you know, then Cooper has to go, like, pilot the Statue of Liberty or something and invite evil Cooper.
Yes.
I'm guessing that's probably going to be the last episode. Think about it.
So this is a pretty heavy scene. But do you remember how it ends?
Yes, yeah.
It's so great. So Jesse, the young cop, comes in, and Truman is like, oh my God, what's going on? And he says, Sheriff Truman, do you want to see my new car? And he says, now Jesse, I'm in a meeting. Can I look at your new car tomorrow? And Jesse leaves. That was so funny.
It's just the, you know, little bits of non sequitur you need. It helps bring you down from the sense of like, oh yeah, like all of our characters are going to be consumed in the flame.
There's that one dirty cop we know who's at the sheriff's department who's an asshole. But I love that all the other young cops clearly, like, view Sheriff Truman as, like, this hero. Like, they love him. They want his approval on down to their new car.
I mean, he's their cop dad. Like,
he
gets to, you know, like, I got this new car. You want to see it?
And Truman's not mad at all. No. He's just like, you know, I'm in a meeting. How about tomorrow?
Yeah.
He's very dad-like in that
way. I do love, like, it's maybe, like, this Sheriff Truman's, like, most endearing character trait is this, like, very sort of profound sense of patience that he has for nonsense and insanity, you know?
It's very true. He and his brother are very similar in that way.
Yeah.
All right. You want to talk about the Buckhorn, South Dakota thing?
Buckhorn, South Dakota.
David Lynch chose that name just so he could say it on screen, right?
Yes.
And make the fuckhorn joke in that one episode. All right. So we have this scene where Gordon Cole and Tammy Baldwin and Albert and everyone have been brought by William Hastings, the Matthew Lillard character and the detective there, who we learned his name is Mackie in this episode. I don't think I'd caught that before. To the site where he met Major Briggs, like where they crossed into the other dimension. And it's just something worth noting. This episode is so casually strange. Uh-huh. I don't think we've said that yet. Like, this is not the weirdest episode of Twin Peaks, like when you compare it to like episode 8 or something.
Yeah.
But in just terms of like how many weird things it throws at you just utterly casually, this is a beyond bizarre episode of TV.
Yeah, it's not like episode 8 or episode 3 where it's like, it's so bizarre that it has to make a point of its own bizarreness. Here, it's just like very casually, oh, there's a hell portal opening in the sky, and there's a zombie lady in this passenger seat vomiting out her like own stomach, and there's just like, you know, this dirty bearded man who blows up Matthew Lillard's head. What? It's just another episode of Twin Peaks.
So I think you summarized this scene pretty well. Yes, I mean, we do have throughout this whole scene, from various characters' POV, we see one of those, like, dirty homeless men.
Dirty bearded men. That's what Gordon Cole calls them, describes them as. That is now, I feel like, the official terminology.
Okay. Yes, the dirty bearded men.
It's like when the X-Files first said the cigarette-smoking man is like, I guess that's what we call that character now. They are just the dirty bearded men.
The dirty bearded men who are also the horsemen of the apocalypse.
Exactly, yeah.
Indeed. So they're kind of dancing around the fringes of this whole scene. So we know this is a place of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have this whole scene where Albert and Cole go in through the fence with their guns drawn.
Yeah, they look more like FBI agents than any character has ever looked at the history of Twin Peaks at this very moment.
They actually seem to be following some sort of protocol, even though they're going to look into a hell portal.
Exactly.
So Cole goes in further, and we hear this like electrical sound buzzing, again, Lynch's electric fetish. And Cole starts like moving back and forth a little. He's like affected by something. And then we get nuts because the sky is swirling, creating a portal. And we have these reverse shots of Cole that are blurred with the image shaking. The portal is spinning. We zoom in towards it. From Albert's POV, everything is shaking as he looks at Cole. At one point, Cole like raises his hands like he's, you know, doing some kind of like speaking in tongues ritual. Yeah. And then we break to this fucking hilarious long shot where it just looks like Cole is having like an episode.
Yeah.
And he's just like shaking. And then we're back into the thick of it. There's this black hole in the center of the portal, and the image just gets crazier and crazier until we see the interior of a building, which does look like the buildings we've seen from the other dimension, and three of the dirty bearded men are inside.
Yeah, standing on this like staircase, and you're down looking up at them, and it reminded me a lot of the shots from Twin Peaks and Fire Walk With Me of inside the Laura Palmer house, of that staircase. That, like, nothing ever really happened on that staircase, but every time you saw a shot of that staircase, it was, like, weirdly, really ominous.
Mm-hmm. And Cole almost disappears, but Albert pulls him back from the brink, and the sky clears up.
Yeah, this was another moment where I was pretty convinced that Gordon Cole was about to die. Like, I thought, like, oh, God, this is where it happens. He's going to be, like, dragged into, like, hell by the dirty bearded men.
I would not be surprised if Lynch gives Gordon Cole, his own character, like a heroic sacrifice at some point in the story.
Sure.
You know? Or maybe like he just goes to live in the other dimension.
He becomes God. He becomes the king. That's the end of it. Is all the other characters are dead, but Gordon Cole is like, you know, it's the apotheosis of Gordon Cole, and he ascends to the throne of heaven, and he makes everything right in the world.
And the last shot is David Lynch's retirement message.
Exactly, yeah.
Anyway, this is great though. When all of that stuff ends, Cole turns to Albert, or Albert turns to Cole and says, well, I guess we found out. We sure did, Albert! And I wrote, no fucking shit.
Yeah.
They sure did. And now over in the grass, another body has appeared. And it's the female body, like, without the head.
Yeah.
And we previously had the female head with no body.
Yeah.
So now we have the rest of the body. Ruth Davenport, I presume, Albert says. And I love through this whole thing, like, because Albert says, you know, that very casual line, and they go over and take the picture and everything. And I wrote, have Albert and Cole seen this kind of shit before? They are very nonchalant and very on top of it. They know what they're doing, and I don't know why.
I mean, the FBIC in Twin Peaks seems to have, like, some weird knowledge of the supernatural. In, like, Fire Walk With Me, you get a bit of a sense of that. Like, yeah. I think in, like, episode one, or, like, whenever we first encountered the FBI in the sort of pilot two-part thing, they, like, that first scene of where they start fighting about the New York City stuff, they seem, like, weirdly comfortable with there being things happening in the world that no, like reason or logic could possibly explain.
And I love that, and part of it is just because in the first episode they establish, you know, Dale Cooper is an FBI agent.
Yeah.
But I love that Lynch and Frost, they gave all this to the FBI. They didn't, like, make up some weird organization. They didn't even do the X-Files thing of, like, Mulder's in the basement, you know?
No, like, Gordon Cole is, like, the fucking director of the FBI or some shit. Like, he's super high up in the organization.
Yep, and this is what they're not doing any, like, looking for counterfeit money in the FBI in this world.
No. Yeah, they're tracking down dirty bearded men that, you know, come out of hell portals to kill people.
Throughout this scene, we keep cutting to Diane, who we know is in cahoots somehow with Evil Coop. And she keeps seeing the dirty bearded man coming in and out of existence. And he's walking low towards the car where the detective and Hastings are. And it's just beautifully terrifying images. He reaches out his hands towards the cop and disappears. And then back in the Hastings car, Hastings like starts to shake. And then we hear a sound and just see a blood explosion.
Yeah.
But for like 2 minutes, Lynch holds back the reveal. It's just like the detective thinks Hastings was shot. Everyone's scared. He says, "We need backup." And Diane takes a drag of her cigarette and says, "There's no backup for this."
Yeah.
I actually don't know if she takes a drag of her cigarette, but in my mind,
I think she does.
Yeah. And then the payoff, the top of William Hastings' head is just gone.
Yeah.
He is it's kind of
like what happened to the dude, like the radio people in episode 8. It's just like their head was just completely crushed and it has disappeared.
Yep. And the kicker to this scene is Cole looks at him and says, he's dead. Well, that was a scene.
Yeah.
Whenever we see this kind of shit these days, I look at these scenes and I'm like, this feels like it's Lynch flashing a message across the screen of like, you ain't seen nothing yet. Uh-huh. Remember, it's only episode 11. It's not going to get more normal from here.
No.
I mean, God, if this is where we are with, you know, if with Gordon Cole prostrating himself before a hell portal, what's the finale? I keep asking this, but it's like,
where? I told you, it's this Cooper is piloting the Statue of Liberty and fighting Evil Coop.
I'd watch it.
That's where we're going.
Oh, anyway, we cut to this really beautiful painterly composition.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful shot.
Of Albert, Diane, and Cole. There's a couple cuts later, but you know what I mean. In the sheriff's station. And it really does look like a painting of these three guys. And they're all, Diane is kind of on this stool, so she's a little higher up. Cole and Albert are a little lower. Cole's hand is shaking, and he kind of holds it to stop it. And he says, someone asks about coffee, and he says, "Coffee? I would like some coffee." And someone else says, "Maybe some more milk for the cat on the roof." And I don't know what any of that means, but there you go. They look at that picture of Ruth, and Albert looks at Diane with sort of raised eyebrows because Cole and Albert seem to recognize something in this. But Diane also is like, what's going on? It's like they know she knows something.
Yeah.
Right? Because the body of Ruth has those numbers on the arm. So that's interesting. Diane seems very freaked out about it. We have another fuck you, Albert exchange, which is great.
Yeah, I know. Fuck you, Albert.
So Cole asks what place those coordinates represent. And Albert starts to say a small town in the north, and he gets cut off by Tammy and Mackley coming in with donuts and coffee. I assume he's saying the Northwest Passage, which is also known as Twin Peaks.
Uh-huh.
All roads lead to Twin Peaks, as we have been predicting.
Yes.
So the portal to hell is in Twin Peaks is the Hellmouth. That's where this is going.
Sure, yeah. It's actually Buffy the Vampire Slayer 2.
We're going to have Giles. Anthony Stewart Head is going to be in this. We find out he's been the librarian all along in Twin Peaks.
I mean, but when I say Buffy the Vampire Slayer 2, I mean it's the sequel to the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie. It doesn't really have much to do with the TV show.
That would be a weird decision. Indeed. All right, anyway, so that's an amazing scene. When we do come back and they're drinking their coffee and everything, there's this great thing where Diane keeps asking if she can smoke a cigarette, and Mackley says she can't, and she leans over and says, "Detective Mackley, you know how good a cigarette would taste with this coffee?" And Laura Dern's so great.
Yeah.
And he finally relents. Smoke them if you got them. And this is where Cole says he saw someone. Albert says he looked like a homeless guy. Diane says she thought she saw someone. And that's where Gordon Cole says, you know, "Dirty bearded man."
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like a dirty bearded man.
Dirty bearded men in a room. So great. From here, we cut to the statue out front of the insurance company, and the boss calls for Dougie! All caps, all exclamation points, as I always write in
Dougie
my notes.
Dougie Jones.
Dougie fucking Jones.
Who has to be lured into the office by a nice cup of coffee by the assistant.
Yep.
It's like a 1 minute long shot of you in the room just looking at him out the window as he stumbles after the coffee.
In the middle of this shot, and throughout the scene, we also learn some details about the boss. His name, if you look at the card on his desk, is Bushnell Mullins.
Yeah.
That is the greatest name they have ever come up with, Bushnell Mullins. And we find out he's got this whole, like, boxing backstory.
Yeah.
Because he's got that poster, which I don't think I connected. That's him.
No, yeah, I assume that was, like, a boxer that he liked, not that was him in his past life.
Yep. He was Batlin Bud. He says, "Nobody keeps Batlin Bud on the ropes for long." Anyway, this scene is amazing because apparently I don't know if I can even get through this. He explains how Dougie's work has exposed organized crime and police corruption in Las Vegas. And the boss goes, Bushnell goes through all of this, that the attempts on Dougie's life confirm this. Throughout, Dougie is totally nonplussed. They also now know, because of Dougie's work, that the Mitchum case we heard about last week was an arson, but a legitimate case. And the shots were called by someone else, which leads Dougie to say, "Someone else? I think you're right, Dougie." I love that no matter what Dougie does, people just love him more.
I love it because this is where we find out, we get the payoff for the scene from fucking like 10 episodes ago or some shit now of him marking up all those papers, that apparently that was what all the connections were, was it was organized crime and different sort of corruption that he was highlighting in these different insurance cases.
And probably the Mitchum stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, the Mitchums want a personal sit-down with Dougie. And since he uncovered and righted the wrong on their behalf, Bushnell thinks they're going to love to meet with Dougie to deliver, and he pulls out of his coat this $30 million check. And we learned they had a secondary policy on Mitchum, so they're covered.
Yeah.
Bushnell doubled down. No one keeps battling Bud on the ropes for long.
Yeah. Dougie's boss is quickly becoming one of, I think, a fan-favorite character.
He's wonderful, and again, I love he's like, the person who actually put all this together is Bushnell, but he's looking at Dougie and, like, again, reading all of this onto Dougie as a cipher, and it's like, it doesn't matter if Dougie doesn't talk, he's apparently changed everyone's lives in the most amazing way.
Yeah.
Like, I do imagine, like, if he becomes Cooper again within some of these last few episodes, you're going to have like a lineup as he leaves Las Vegas of Naomi Watts and Sonny Jim and Bushnell and everyone, and they're all just going to be hugging him and crying and like, "You've changed our lives so much." And Cooper will go over to Janie and say, "I think I'm going to miss you the most." And then he's going to get off in a literal hot air balloon because the Wizard of Oz connection.
Sure.
No. Anyway. Love it. But I wrote in my notes, this all seems very naive of Mr. Mullins, but it turns out okay.
Hey, I think Batlin Bud has some insight that maybe we are not privy to. So
indeed. So we cut over to the Mitchum's house, where the Mitchum brothers are eating cereal and reading paper.
Yeah.
The Jim Belushi one comes in, drinks his coffee, pours some Raisin Bran Crunch.
Yes.
I love the detail that they didn't buy Raisin Bran, they bought Raisin Bran Crunch.
It's a good cereal.
It's a very good, it's one of my favorites. But a lot of hilarious small details, and he says, "All right, Rodney, I had a dream. All fucking night. Dreamt about killing that Douglas Jones fuck. Just hated him so bad. I can't wait to kill this guy." And he looks over at the clock, and it's 2:23 in the afternoon. So that makes no sense, because they're just getting out of their beds and having breakfast. Yeah. So that's weird. And he's mad that he has to wait another 2.5 hours. And he looks down at his cereal and says, "I can't eat this." And, like, pushes it aside. And I learned to love the Mitchum brothers in this episode. Yeah. They are wonderful characters. I think it really filled up to my description last week that they are like a parody of Tarantino gangsters.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Because apparently parody. They seem to kind of have hearts of gold deep down.
Yeah, it does feel like they maybe aren't that bad, even if they were planning on killing Dougie. They thought that Dougie robbed them of $30 million.
Yeah.
It was like, people have killed other people for worse reasons than that.
You know, they might have stolen those hearts of gold, but I do think they have them deep down.
Yeah,
anyway, so we go back to the lobby of Dougie's building, and across the way, Dougie sees a vision of Mike in the red room beckoning him over to the fucking coffee shop.
Yeah.
And he comes out with this big box, and we don't know what's in the box. And Bushnell,
what's in the box?
Yeah, Bushnell makes sure he has the check. Apparently they're going to Santino's, and Bushnell says, "Oh, you're going to like that. I'm in your corner, champ. Knock him dead." And he pinches Dougie's cheek, and this is the most visibly confused Dougie like ever gets on the show.
Yeah.
Anyway, and he just says, "Dead," muttering that, which is great. The driver has to physically put Dougie's legs into the car.
Yep.
It's the driver from earlier who picked him up in episode 3 or 4, which is
Red Door, right?
Yep. Then I love this sequence where we have this POV shot from the car driving down the road. The music on the radio is an indie rock version of Viva Las Vegas. Love it. And eventually they get out into the Vegas desert. Just big, gorgeous shots of these vistas. It really does feel like David Lynch binged Breaking Bad and was like, "This is Nevada. They did New Mexico. Close enough. We can do this too."
Yeah.
And I love it. Let's do it our own David Lynch way. The Mitchums are out waiting in the desert in their car. And Belushi is still worried about his dream. And he says, "In it, you know, Rodney, your candy cut was completely healed." And he pulls off the Band-Aid. And Rodney touches it and says, "I'll be damned." So there's something about this dream going on.
Yeah.
So I love it. Anyway, they're having this standoff in the desert where the driver once again has to drag Dougie out of the car and lead him over to the Mitchums. And they're about to kill him, and Belushi remembers something. He says, "See that box he's holding there? That was in my dream. There's something in that box, and if that something is what I saw in my dream, we can't kill him. If he's got this one certain thing that's in that box, it means he's not our enemy, Rodney." And I love he's, like, so into this. Like, it's one certain thing. And he, like, whispers it to him, and we don't see it. And so Rodney goes...
I want to stop this for a second here. I just want to highlight, this is another point in the episode where there was a part of me that's like, Dougie's going to get fucking shot. Like, there's, like legit... Because, like, especially it was when Dougie says dead before he gets into the car. It's like, oh,
you know,
fuck.
You know what?
Oh,
fuck. You know what I thought we were going to get?
What?
I thought he might get shot and we'd get the inverse of, like, what happened to Evil Coop.
Sure,
where he also would, like, the dirty bearded men would come and, like, resurrect him somehow.
Yeah, but, like, I was really concerned that, like, the other Mitchum brother was just going to ignore what Jim Belushi was saying and just shoot Dougie anyways. Yeah. Or, like, the gun would go off by accident or something. Because this is another part of the episode where, like, guns are really prominent, which has, like, not been a big thing in other Twin Peaks episodes. So it's a recurring theme because it's in every major section. Because, you know, we also had Gordon Cole and Albert had their guns out and stuff. So it's the gun stuff is everywhere, but nobody actually gets shot in the episode. So it's like Chekhov's gun or something. It's just like, someone's going to get fucking shot, and the only person that's got a gun pointed at them and the episode's getting close to over is fucking Dougie. Dougie's going to get shot, and my heart would have been broken, but I could have totally seen it happening.
Yep.
And him actually being dead. If he fucking died in episode 11, I would be like, yeah, I guess that's how it goes. I don't fucking know. Like, it could have been anything.
It's not very worried. It's not Chekhov's gun. It's Lynch's gun, which is it's not going to go where you expect or anywhere in particular, but you're going to enjoy the journey along the way.
Exactly.
Anyway.
So you can continue now with the summary.
But it's so great. I love, you know, the Mitchum brothers like to say it's 1,000,000-to-1 shot what's in that box. But if it is, this man is not our enemy.
You have to listen to me. He like grabs his head. He's like, you have to listen to me. You have to promise me you won't kill him.
And it's actually hard for me to even remember how I felt, like, tense in the moment, because the rest of the scene is so happy and joyous the rest of this episode. But anyway, they go over there, and Rodney pulls he's got his gun on him, and he looks in the box and says, is that a cherry pie? And
cherry pie?
Indeed. And it tells him to frisk him just in case. And frisks him. Rodney finds the check, and he saunters over like he's dancing to Rodney in the most hilarious way. And they have the check, and they're so happy. And he says, "I love this guy." And I wrote, "We all do."
Yep.
Dougie Jones. He's the best person.
Dougie fucking Jones.
This has also made for some amazing memes on Twitter. The one that I think you retweeted too.
Yes.
It was the two of them like laughing over the $30 million check. And it was David Lynch and Mark Frost, May of 2015.
Yeah.
Which I can totally imagine.
Yep.
But anyway, they take Dougie out for drinks at a nice restaurant. They get dinner. In a weird detail, they're disturbed his kid doesn't own a gym set.
Because, you know, the thing that, like, movies do where it's like you cut into this conversation mid-progress and they're just talking about something random. And here they're just talking about the most specific, like, I didn't know the gym set? That's no way for someone to grow up or something. It's very weird.
Oh, I love it. Anyway, they're going to do a toast, although they have to give Dougie his drink because he doesn't know how this works.
He keeps on reaching for the one drink. It's like, now it's Dougie this time.
And they say, here's to you, Dougie. My thoughts exactly. Yep. Because we all want to give a toast to Mr. Dougie Jones.
Yep.
But as the piano plays, like there's this piano player who we keep cutting to, and Dougie hears something. The piano slows down. It's a different, slower tune. And this old woman walks over to Dougie and exclaims, Mr. Jackpots!
Mr. Jackpots!
And that's the woman from episode 3. And she explains how Dougie changed her life. She has her son again. She has a house. She has her life back. How can I ever thank you, she says. There's this beautiful music playing, and the whole scene, Kyle MacLachlan is looking off upwards, like, at nothing in particular, or at everything.
Yeah, which it keeps on cutting to the Mitchum brothers, that they're just kind of looking at themselves like, yeah, that's this guy. This guy's a hero.
Yeah, it's so great. And I love it, because she turns over to the Mitchums and says, I hope you realize what a special person you have dining with you. He saved my life. It's so lovely. The Mitchum brothers are so touched. Everyone's so touched. It's like an amazingly happy scene throughout. It's so pervasively happy. But then we have this interesting ending where the three like pink girls, including Candy, they and the waitstaff bring over pie and coffee. And Dougie's very intrigued by the pie and coffee. And I have to say, I should know by now not to expect that Dougie's going to wake up.
Yeah.
But throughout this whole scene, I really thought he might wake up in this scene. There was something about the atmosphere. There was something about how, like, it felt like there was a point of tension that was going to break. And he doesn't. But were you this feeling the same thing?
There was a part of me, yeah, there was a part of me where, because I feel like he gets the closest in a weird way. Because he says, like, damn, fine, at one point.
Yep.
But, like, but the best detail is of, like, of, again, of Lynch just sort of setting that up. And he's been doing this since episode 3, where we first met the lady and having him be Mr. Jackpots, is him setting up this idea of there's going to be something that he responds to that's going to be, it's the coffee, it's the owl, it's the whatever. He sees something and it's like, oh, now, like he remembers that he's Agent Cooper. And, but then David Lynch sort of slams that back in your face and says, nope, not yet, or maybe not ever. And in this, it's the martini glass thing that they do it before, they have the toast before the pie stuff comes, and he does the thing for reaching for the glass. Then they do the pie, and you get that moment where he says, damn fine, you're like, oh my god, maybe he's coming back. And then they do another toast, and he does the exact same fucking thing of reaching for the glass, so he clearly has had no more progress at all.
But it feels like we're getting closer, and maybe it's naivety.
It's never happening. It's never happening. It's like what I said on your Twitter questionnaire. It's nope. He's never coming out as Dougie Jones now and forever.
I love it. It's great. Either way, there is an interesting thing here where Candy is, again, unresponsive. Like, she seems like kind of a female Dougie in some weird way. Like, sure, there's a different spirit in this body.
I made that connection, too, because it was the first time we had them in the same scene together.
Yeah, but, like, they keep asking Candy, like, why were you late? And she finally exclaims, so much traffic! It was incredible! There were cars everywhere! And I love how, like, I want Candy and Dougie in a room together.
Yeah.
You know, like,
trying to have an insane conversation.
Yep. Dougie, meanwhile, he really loves that pie.
Yep.
Dougie does say damn fine, and he does pause more at that. That's why it's like, mm-hmm. Oh god, is something happening? And then they do a toast. Here's to the pie that saved your life, Dougie, and our money. And Dougie eats some more pie. They get another pie for Dougie. With his mouth full, he says, friend. That's the last word of the episode, because we go over to the piano man. He finishes one song, starts another, and the credits roll.
Yep.
And thus ends another absolutely incredible episode of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, it was a real roller coaster ride, this one. It started with Becky running out of the house with a fucking gun, or like that woman half dead crawling through the bushes, and that. And then it went to hell portals, and then it ends with Dougie and his two would-be assassins having apple pie together as he says the word friend in his muffled voice while he's shoveling apple pie into his mouth.
So good.
Yeah.
It's so fucking good. I have to say, Game of Thrones has had 2 episodes this season. Very good. I actually think Game of Thrones has maybe taken a little something of a leap as it enters its home stretch. But I feel somewhat unfair to poor Game of Thrones because mm-hmm. I watch it and I'm like, very good. I talked to my brother about it because we watched that together. I go online. It's the wonderful thing about Game of Thrones is it's the one show everyone watches in this very fractured world.
And yeah, so except kinda, for me.
Except for you. It's except a very, for me. But it's a very communal thing. And then and I finish that and I go watch Twin Peaks and I forget everything that happened in Game of Thrones because it's good, but it's not this.
Yeah. I can't tell you what else I did on Sunday.
No.
And that was the last thing I basically did on Sunday other than sleep was watch that episode of Twin Peaks. But it definitely consumes your sort of like mental space for sure.
And I wouldn't have it any other way.
No.
All right. So that's Twin Peaks for this week.
The episode 11. We're slowly barreling towards that conclusion.
Next week, Sean.
Next week.
Is our 200th episode.
Good God.
Yeah. So do you want to give the folks a little preview of what we might be doing with this?
Oh, I mean, I feel like we have a couple of sort of plans hatching, you know.
We do. So we're not going to tell you everything. I should say, I think, we still have to talk about this off the air.
Yeah.
I think episode 200 will not be on our normal day next week.
Probably
not. We will have one probably next Wednesday. But I think before then, we'll have episode 200. And it'll be a special episode because we're going to have a special topic. And I don't want to have Twin Peaks in the news and everything else.
Yeah.
So we might record this one soonish and then get it to you guys. But that'll be our 200th episode. So you might have a 2-podcast week coming.
Yeah.
We're going to have some fun announcements of new things we're doing with the podcast, with our, I don't want to sound like a YouTube ambassador, but our brand or whatever you want to say.
Sure, yes.
We're going to be expanding in some ways.
We're influencers.
I want to go modestly slip my wrists. But no, yeah, we're going to have some new projects we're announcing, and I think it's going to be very fun. Yeah.
We've got that hot new website up.
Yep, got that hot new website up, and we're going to have some new things up that we will announce next week on the air, or whenever episode 200 drops. So look for that. It'll be a fun one. The topic of episode 200, just to give you a little tease. We decided, we've known this was coming for a while.
Yeah, you know, as a recap, at episode 100, we did our top 100 stuff lists, and I was pretty adamant that we should do a top 200 stuff list, but you poo-pooed that idea.
Well, it seemed a little hard to come up with.
I mean, it maybe would have been a bit much.
Yeah. And if you're wondering what the hell is a top 100 stuff list, and maybe you haven't been listening for the last 100 episodes, which is totally understandable, you can go back, and weeklystuffpodcast.com, episode 100 is there. You will learn what the top 100 stuff is.
Yep. You might be surprised by number one.
Yes.
Well, both the number ones.
Yes, indeed. So that was an interesting episode. But for episode 200, if you remember, our very first episode of this show, when it was WGTC Radio and all that, number one is we did a list of our top 10 films of all time.
Yep.
And that was 5 years ago now. Over five years. And we were just starting college.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were just starting the show. A lot has changed in 5 years.
A whole lot.
And it's a list I've really wanted to revisit.
Yeah,
and I think,
too.
Yeah, you did too. So I said, I think that would be a good idea. And so that's what we've been working on. I've watched like 60 movies in the last 2 months.
Yeah.
Because I've gone down some rabbit holes. And we're going to do that for episode 200. We are going to redo our top 10 films list. And to give you a preview, if you knew my list from 2012, not a single one of those films is on my list. So it is all new for me, mostly new for you, I think.
Yeah, it's almost all new. There's a couple of old hanger-ons, and there might be a new number one.
Indeed. So this is not just a simple retread, but I think it's going to be a really fun episode. I'm so excited to do this one for episode 200 and then to share some other cool news with you guys. So we will be doing that soon, episode 200, and then we will probably go home and cry thinking about all the time we've spent looking at this microphone.
Yeah, good Lord.
We're not even this. We'll do some more remembrances on next week, but as a little preview, I say looking at this microphone. We had a different blue microphone for a while, and that was nice. But before that, we had my laptop, or we had a headset you owned that we plugged in. We never told you guys this.
No.
But we plugged into the computer and used that as a mic because it was slightly better. We've gotten better at this.
Yeah, we've come a long way in 200 episodes, almost 200 episodes now.
Yeah.
But the thing I'm sort of most dreading, Jonathan, is now after we do next week's, if we do episode 200 and we do our top 10 movies thing, what the fuck do we do for episode 300?